Select Committee on Education is called to order. Before we begin, we have a couple of housekeeping items, members. But first, I would like to take the opportunity to have us introduce ourselves to our attendees and presenters this morning as a committee. So perhaps we could start to my far right. Isn't that an anomaly? And we could start with Representative Roblin and move on down and make some introductions.
I'm Representative Arnie Roblin. Represent District 9, which is Coos Bay to Florence.
I'm Representative Sarah Gelser, and I represent House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath.
Good morning. I'm Representative Gene Wisnett, and I live in Sun River, and I represent rural Deschutes County, Oregon's playground.
Yeah. Always pitching.
Of course, we tried to burn some of it down this week, last week, but we survived and had great service by the U.S. Forest Service, and that's all. No more speech.
Brad Avakian, Northeast Washtenaw County, one Portland Public School, the rest the Beaverton School District. And as many of you know, I've worked very hard for a decade or so on public education issues. I want to thank the Speaker for appointing this committee. I think between us and the Senate, we might have four or five different education committees working now, which I'm very grateful to see, and I think if we were to be graded on quantity, we'd have an A+. But I appreciate you being here today to give us your opinions about the state of public education, and hope that next session that those are helpful as we craft something new for Oregon.
Thank you, Representative Avakian, also Vice Chair of this committee.
Representative John Dolan, House District 59. I live in the Dalles, new home to Oregon's Google. I represent Madras, where the prison is on time and under budget.
Always pitching.
And you can float the John Day or the Deschutes River with me anytime. I'd like to thank the Speaker for this committee. I was born excited for education, and I think this committee can take us someplace. Thank you.
Representative Barker will be joining us shortly. Representative Barker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Debbie Farr. I represent District 14, Eugene, Bethel, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. And I've got about 20-plus years of volunteer experience in my local school district, the Bethel School District. My husband and I collectively have about 25 years of community and volunteer and civic duty, because to us it is our duty. And I started out popping popcorn to buy playground equipment and was the only mom that showed up for the parent group meetings and organized field trips and after school activities. So education is something I believe very strongly in, and I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank the Speaker as well for forming this committee and allowing me to be part of it.
I'm Karen Minnis. I'm the State Representative in House District 49 and also the Speaker of the House. And I'm just very pleased with the makeup of this committee. I think we attempted to try and put the best and the brightest. We wanted a cross-pollinization between ways and means and policy, and I think we've accomplished that. And I look forward to a very good comprehensive package coming out of this committee and with recommendations going forward in the next session. I want to compliment the chalkboard project in particular today. That's their agenda items are going to be presented before us today. I want to compliment your efforts and the time and the energy and the resources you've put to bear on taking a look at our education process in the state. Investing the dollars to talk to Oregonians across the state and hear what they have to say. And so with great anticipation to hear your presentation and look at what your recommendations are and the things you're hearing across the state of Oregon. And hopefully this committee will take those items and vet them and see what's doable for next session and then maybe down the road what's now and maybe what's later. So I'm very excited and look forward to a great product coming out of this committee.
I'm Susan Morgan. I represent a legislative district in the southern part of Douglas County and portions of Josephine and Jackson counties. And I also want to add my voice to the thought that the work that this committee is going to do is going to be very important. I appreciate the speaker's appointments to the committee. I think she truly has chosen the people in the system that have worked most closely with education issues from the policy perspective and from the budget perspective, and that we bring a collectively large body of knowledge about the subject with us. And also to commend the work that's been done by the Chalkboard Project and by the Oregon Business Council and other groups over the past years, and most directly in the interim, around the issues not just with the K to 12 system, but also how it interfaces into the community college system and the four-year system. And I think this collective work that's been done has very much helped raise the profile for the need for education in general and the importance of a strong education system to the state of Oregon. But it's also brought forward, I think, a great body of information on the strengths and the weaknesses of the system, and it really has enriched the dialogue around what to do to make the system work better for Oregon, especially in the future. So I do salute the time and the energy and the resources that the Chalkboard Project and the other folks have put into this. And just thank you very much. I think that it comes as no surprise to all of us that you're having much the same discussion that we've had in this body for many years, and that you've helped us, I think, clarify and bring information that people trust forward to enrich the dialogue, and that is so much appreciated. This is probably one of the most arcane and entrenched areas of policy that the state has to deal with. And reaching out beyond this body, I think, is very important to furthering that dialogue. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Keller, our committee administrator, would you like to introduce yourself and our worthwhile assistant over there?
Jim Keller, I'm your committee administrator, and our committee assistant is Patricia Neusack.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Keller, for the coffee and tea that's back here for committee members. We all appreciate that. Yay. My name is Linda Flores. I'm state representative for House District 51, which encompasses Clackamas, Damascus, Boring, Estacada, Beaver Creek, and other small areas, as well as some small portion of southeast Portland in Multnomah County. Now, before we move forward to the business before us, I would like to call the committee's attention to the rules for our committee. And if you have taken an opportunity to scan through those, I would ask that you do that now. And I would call your attention also specifically to point 9 regarding measures to be pre-session filed or recommended approvals on policy bills that does require a majority of the appointed members of this committee.
Madam Chair, are you ready for a motion?
I would be.
I would move adoption of the rules as proposed.
It has been moved.
Second.
And seconded that the rules for this committee be adopted as proposed. Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Now, not to be repetitive and or redundant, because we're looking for redundancies and trying to do away with them, I would like also to express my appreciation to the speaker for the appointment of this committee. I think it is a wonderful opportunity for us as a body of representatives to review the recommendations that have been brought forward, have been explored, have been gone into at great depth from the private sector, and I think that's a very important integration into the policy work that we need to consider. I would be hopeful and encourage each one of us to be open to the recommendations that we hear as we move forward in our 6 committee hearings to explore and to consider those areas that are brought to us by the various private sector entities. Today it is a great pleasure to have the August chalkboard project with us. And Adam Smith, I understand you're going to make some introductions and comments.
Madam Chair, as you can see, I was well replaced by our president, Sue Hildick, so we'll, if we may, offer her the chance to start out.
Ms. Hildick.
I may never hear that again. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity. We are very excited to be able to share with you the results of our work and to learn from you your interests and see where we can find common ground. I think you know Foundations for a Better Oregon was formed in 2003 by five of Oregon's leading foundations, the Oregon Community Foundation, the Ford Family Foundation, the Meyer Memorial Trust, the Collins Foundation, and the Geldwin Foundation. And I'm delighted today that Norm Smith could be here representing the Ford Family Foundation, and Eric Lindauer representing the Oregon Community Foundation, and Debbie Craig representing the Meyer Memorial Trust. Unfortunately, our colleagues from Geldwin and Collins are on site visiting grantees out of the area, so they couldn't be here, but they send their regards. And you may remember that together these five foundations have put over $50 million into K-12 projects in Oregon just since the year 2000, just to give you a sense of the scale at which they are trying to support innovations and policy improvements around K-12. I think they came together in 2003 to ask the question, was there more that they could do? Could they help in sort of looking at the systemic changes around the system? And today we're very excited to tell you that Chalkboard now has 20 funders. They're all foundations. Most of them are from Oregon, a couple of national foundations. But really, I think there's a growing commitment from the philanthropic community to be of service and of help as you look at the really complicated issues around K-12. So I know that each of my colleagues here would like to say a few things, and I'd like to let that happen. Norm?
Madam Chair and Madam Speaker, and of course Representative Morgan from my home district, whose wake I followed in this morning coming up the freeway, I'm sure. I'm Norm Smith, and I am one of the board members of the Foundations for a Better Oregon, which was the structure created by the five individual foundations, and its sole project is the Chalkboard Project. And so I am here in that capacity today. But as you know, I do spend the better part of the rest of my week with the Ford Family Foundation in Roseburg. And we have been, along with our colleagues here, committed in many ways to the purposes of education in Oregon, largely in higher education in particular, where we invest on the order of $10 million a year in private scholarships, assisting people in need to go to all of Oregon's public and private colleges year in and year out, something on the order of 1,000 people in college right now under one of our programs on a given day. Maybe more specifically, a few years ago when Governor Kitzhaber announced that it was important for Oregon to go from zero to some improved number of board-certified teachers, we investigated that and found that quality teachers was a linchpin to a quality education system. And today I'm pleased to say that we were able to begin that process, and Oregon has carried on, but we underwrote something on the order of the first 250 board-certified teachers in Oregon, and I think it's paying dividends today, and I think it will continue to pay dividends for the state system. Rural community schools has been a project of multiple years, which we are just winding up and learning what we have accomplished across the state. But these are the kinds of investments that the Ford Family Foundation has made. But quite frankly, it was this convergence by the five foundations around the simple question, well, what are you all spending your money on? And five of us looked at each other and said, education. Why? Because it's important. And why are we all doing it differently? Well, I don't know. We just have each picked a piece and done something. Well, that hasn't been wasted, but I think that's the beginning of the conversation we had that took some time, that said we could be more powerfully aligned on education and be more helpful to the state as a whole if we created a central project. And so we sit before you today representing that project, the Chalkboard Project. We think by now, there are any number of ways we can count this, but I believe we've easily touched 75,000 Oregonians in this conversation.
not just something casual, but in many cases they had to take an active part. They had to respond to something. They had to do something. They had to express an opinion. They had to show up. They had to get online. They had to do research. And this represents every corner of the state of Oregon. You're going to hear in a little while from Adam Davis, and you will find out that we have tested the thoughts in various ways in every corner of the state of Oregon. We can even differentiate between geographical sectors of the state on thoughts and opinions about public education. And believe me, there are variations. One size will not fit all, and you know that from so many of the things that you do. The goals of Chalkboard can be summed up pretty clearly, and Shirley Skidmore, our communications director to my left, has a slide that really relates to our vision, and it's that every student in Oregon get the quality education required to succeed in college or in the workplace or in life. It's a pretty bold vision, but I think we want nothing less for the children of this state. Our mission, then, is to help deliver superior K-12 public education to Oregon students by ensuring a quality education system accountable to Oregonians who support it with adequate and stable funding. So we started with the issue of what is quality, how would a quality system be accountable to the stakeholders, and then and only then do you talk about what that costs and how to stably fund it. That's the process we followed for the last several years. So our commitment now is to create a more informed and engaged public who understand and address the tough choices and trade-offs required to build stronger and better schools. As a former legislator, some of you know, I particularly am aware of the challenges that you face. This has been a long conversation, and I think we could all agree talk has not been cheap. It's a very expensive conversation. That's one of the reasons we felt that private foundations, without seeking public funding, could carry on this conversation, perhaps as a surrogate for others who have a like vision. Chalkboard's level of research can, I think, be of great service to you in all that you are doing, particularly in the emphasis on change. Much of what we're going to deliver to you is based on the best practices, not just in the United States, but around the world. So we think we can say we have some information about what is known to work, what the public thinks about that work, and then there will be some buckets of suggestions, as we call them, that will not have as strong a test, but for the most part, we've done, I think, the deepest testing of any organization in the state. So on the behalf of the rest of the Foundations for a Better Oregon board, made up of two members from each of the five foundations, I want to thank you for this opportunity and for your interest. We sincerely hope that we have something to say to you that resonates. Thanks very much. Mr. Lindauer.
I'll turn that one. Yes, right here. Let's do that.
Good morning. My name is Eric Lindauer, and I serve as the chair of the board of the Oregon Community Foundation. Sitting in Norm's chair, I immediately took on a whole different aura and intellect level. So, much higher, much higher. All of a sudden, I feel this great sense of wisdom. Let me just make a couple of comments first before I address the Chalkboard project and our involvement. I want to say to all of you, and in particular, Madam Speaker, two things. First, thank you. Thank you very much for getting out ahead of this issue now. The wisdom of pulling together this committee, the thought that you put into it in terms of selecting the representatives on this committee, and now here we are in August talking about an issue that's probably going to be and will be the number one issue in the legislative session. To get in front of this issue now is so important, and I really thank you for that, because without this kind of lead-in, the kind of work that you can do and the committee can do, the results at the end when the halls are filled and your time is critical, is not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So the thought that you gave to this speaker and the folks that you put on this committee is absolutely critical. And to the members of the committee, thank you. Thank you for your willingness, not only as public citizens and legislators representing all parts of Oregon, but for your willingness to look at this most significant issue. If you asked Oregonians, and polls have been taken, what is the number one issue facing the state today? Absolutely, unconditionally, the number one issue facing the state today is public education and funding of public education. So this issue is in the minds of all Oregonians. And when we looked at this 3 years ago and we said, as a foundation, what should we be doing about this issue? What is our role as a foundation to look at this issue, and what involvement should we bring to the table? We said we should be doing something. We should be involved. And so 3 years ago, our board said, let's see if we can pull our fellow colleagues and other foundations together to form a collaborative effort to look at this huge issue of education and see if we can fund that and let's call it chalkboard. And let's find someone as dynamic as Sue Hildick to head this up and take charge of this enormous project and see if we can be collaborative in our efforts to work with the legislature to come up with solutions to this problem. So that's really how it happened. We had a conversation in our board that said, we need to address this issue, and we can't do it alone. We can't do it alone. And so we said, let's join with our fellow foundation board members. And for the first time, this is the first time that all foundations in Oregon have focused together on a single subject. And why not? And why not the most important issue facing the state today? And so we joined together with the fine foundations and formed the Foundations for Better of Oregon. We had the wisdom to find Sue Hildick and to have her serve as our president, and Chalkboard was launched. That's how it came about. And we have funded this now for the last 3 years. We're in it for the long haul. We want to work with you in a collaborative way to share with you what the information that we have gathered to this point, and to see if we can together, as we should, work as citizens and as legislators to see if we can find a common solution to many of the issues that face education today. So we know that if you looked at all of the proposals that we're now going to be sharing with you, 75% of those are going to come from a legislative resolution. And for that reason alone, we need this collaborative process. We need to have this partnership. You need us by virtue of what we have developed up to this point. We need you, and all of Oregon needs you, to help come with the solutions that we think will address the three issues that Norm spoke of. So we think that if we look at the information that we're going to share with you and look at the focus of research-based solutions, not just what we think will work, but what we know will work, that and we're willingness to put in the time and put in the money and put in the energy to come up with some form of resolution and reform to the education system, that this can work. And our commitment to you is to be with you in this process, to be with you in terms of being collaborative, to working with this committee, to providing the resources that we have gathered up to this point, and to be a partner with you in coming up with solutions. We think that when we look at these three factors that drive the focus, if you looked at all of Oregonians and saying, well, what do we want in our education system? The factors that came out were quality. We want a quality education system. We want it to be accountable. We want accountability in the education system, and we want to find a way to publicly fund it. And these are issues that you folks have been dealing with for years and years, and we need to find a solution. And we felt as foundations that we should be involved in this project. We should be involved in finding those solutions, and that's why we formed Foundations for Better Oregon and created the Chalkboard Project. So we want to thank you for your involvement. We're here for the long term. We think the information that we've developed at this point in terms of the 75,000 Oregonians that we've involved in this project up to this point, you've seen the interest in the editorial pages of your local newspapers about the chalkboard project. The work that we've done has laid the groundwork for where we are right today. So this is an opportunity, I think, that's rare in Oregon. And that is, we have this unique collaborative effort of involving foundations that who have been involved and want to have public input to reach a point where we can bring to you that information, share with you, work with you, and to come up with solutions that we think will serve all Oregonians and address the issues of education. So we thank you for, Madam Speaker, for this committee. This is the beginning. This is the start, and I'm so pleased that it's August and it's not January. And we think that with what Sue has developed up to this point, this is a wonderful way to start this process. So thank you very much. Thank all of you for your willingness to listen to us and to work with us, and hopefully we can come up with a solution that's good for not only our taxpayers, but also, more importantly, our children. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you very much for inviting us. I'm Debbie Craig, and I've been with Meyer Memorial Trust for over 10 years. And we're here today to, first of all, share with you how important we think it is. You obviously have formed this committee early, and you're spending time and devotion trying to solve some problems. We share that with you. Meyer Memorial Trust for years never was involved in public education, and suddenly we saw how important this was to our state, and we're deeply involved now. And we're involved with the Foundations for Better Oregon, the Chalkboard Project. This is all demonstrating how passionate we feel about public education in the state of Oregon. Meyer is honored to participate with this, and I'm pleased to tell you that we are behind this 100%. I'll agree with them. We're in it for the long haul, and we don't know how long that's going to be. Both our speakers have alluded to the fact this is the first time the foundations have ever gotten together. That shows you how important we see this issue. This isn't a routine meeting of foundations. We feel at Meyer that Chalkboard's findings are so important that our grant making in the area of public education, we are now structuring to put in line with the findings of Chalkboard. In other words, if Chalkboard has found that a certain issue of accountability is important, then we want to structure our grants so that it follows that theme. We believe that the research being done by Chalkboard is so important and so valuable that any grants that we make in the future, we want to have aligned with the Chalkboard findings. And I'm assuming you're thinking in your head, gosh, maybe legislation should be aligned as well, because that's where we're at right now. We are so involved in public education that we're partnering now with the Gates Foundation in a huge $25 million project trying to see how effective converting large high schools into smaller high schools can improve the achievement of our students and close the achievement gap. And our early results from some of our early schools are looking very good. So this is a big commitment from all the foundations, from ours, particularly Meyer. It's an area we are going into in a big way. We are going in totally collaborative, and we are now structuring all our work in education along the findings of Chalkboard. That shows you how committed we are. So thank you for your time, and I hope you'll follow that lead, and you'll structure some of your legislative issues along the findings of Chalkboard. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Debbie and Eric and Norm. Our purpose this morning really was to share with you a quick recap of our timeline and then have you hear from Adam Davis about what we've learned from Oregonians across the state, and then walk through our proposals where we are at this point. And John Tapania is here to help elaborate or go deeper into any questions you might have. But if I can draw your attention to, I hope you each have a packet from us, and there is a document that looks like this, which is our timeline. And it shows you from where we started and where we are today. If you look at the top part, you see all the portions of public input that we have asked for throughout this process. From the very beginning, we believe that asking the owners of Oregon's education system what they value and believe was really the place to start, and really trying to thoroughly understand that. and we did that deeply, and Adam will share that with you. The bottom part of the timeline shows the research we've done, the stakeholder groups that have been convened, the expert finance group that came together under Jim Scherzinger's leadership, the different pieces of the project that has really led us to where we are today. We did put out a 15-point action plan last June, and you saw that on your committee agenda today. We're going to talk about each one of those things. And just so you know where we are in our process, we are now taking the time to synthesize and review everything we've learned over the past 2 years. The board is going through a process of evaluating that and looking at that, and our intention is to put our final package forward in the fall. We're getting very close. We're winnowing as we go along, so we're very close to that, and that's what you'll hear about today. I'd like to now invite Adam Davis to come up and share with you what we have learned from Oregonians.
Just one moment, Sue. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sue, what have you briefed this to the NCLS and to the ALEC people? I see you referenced in your report some of the conversation with them, but have...
We have not given them a full briefing, Representative Wisnett. I can put that on our list to do.
Madam Chair, follow-up? Is that part of your plan to have some experts from those two organizations come in or talk to this committee?
We had not contemplated that, but we will certainly take that under advisement.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would also like to recognize your leadership and Representative Roblin's leadership on Chalkboard's legislative point team. We've had the pleasure of learning from you for the last year, and that has been to our benefit greatly. And you are joined in that effort by Senator Johnson and Senator Starr. So I wanted to recognize your assistance to us.
Members, Adam, with your permission, as you go through, there, as questions might arise, and at the risk and recommendation that we not derail too much of the presentation, I would suggest that as you have questions, that with your permission, Adam, we'd be able to insert them as we move forward.
That'd be fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Madam Speaker, members of the committee, it's great to see you again. I am here to kind of give you an overview of what we have learned from the public opinion research that has been done to support the chalkboard efforts. And it's important to keep in mind that there have been two tracks here of research. One is the public opinion research, and the other is the best practices research, as Sue's described, and John will be giving you an overview of the best practices research. I want to just quickly give you an idea of what kind of public opinion research has been done to support the chalkboard project. And I must say, I've been doing with my partners public opinion research in the state of Oregon for, it's hard to believe, over 30 years now. And I must tell you that this is probably the most in-depth research that's ever been conducted in the state of Oregon about Oregonians' attitudes regarding a particular issue. There have been some other big studies, and some of you were part of that. There was the 1992 Oregon Values and Beliefs study, very in-depth study. 1,200 Oregonians interviewed basically face-to-face. It was nearly an hour questionnaire. 2002, there was the 2002 Oregon Values and Beliefs study. Telephone, we were down to a 15, 20-minute questionnaire. And along comes the Chalkboard Project. And we had a sample size that really allowed us to do, as Norm described, a statistically reliable regional analysis. And that's unusual, because most of the research you all see is, first of all, of voters, and second of all, it's usually of a statewide proportional sample. But this was stratified to provide good information at the regional level, and we talked to Oregonians. We talked to the general population. In addition to the survey research that was done, the baseline study, done now a couple of years ago, since that time, we have done a lot of qualitative research as well. And the idea there was to look at the numbers that we saw in our survey research findings and find out what is motivating people to feel the way they are about these issues related to public K through 12 education in Oregon. And the only way you can do that is really to spend time with people in a focus group and really ask them about these issues. How do you feel? Why are you feeling the way you are? Part of that focus group research was with people that are on the front lines of public K through 12 education. We met with teachers. We met with principals, superintendents, members of school boards, parents, non-parents, and we asked them about the schools, what's working, what's not working. And we took a lot of that, and that also helped the chalkboard project zero in on things that they felt need to be done to improve K through 12 education in Oregon, along with John's work on best practices. Over the last 2 years, we've gone out over and over again to test the recommendations that the chalkboard project was working on. And we did that in a variety of ways. We did it with scientific telephone survey research. We did it with online surveys. We provided anyone who wanted to weigh in by simply going to the website and sharing with us how they feel about public K through 12 education and the specific proposals that the Chalkboard Project was developing. So I must tell you, it was an extensive undertaking. It still is very in-depth and very broad. I thought, Madam Chair, that it would be worth kind of zeroing in on some of the key things that over these last 2 years we have been hearing about. And these are just some. We could spend the entire day here talking about how Oregonians feel about quality education, how they feel about accountability, how they feel about funding. But I thought I'd share with you just some things that really jump out at me when I look at the crosstabs, the quantitative research results, and when I look at those focus group tapes and I hear people talking about it. I want to just take a look at quality education. And one thing that was really, really clear early on, and is still clear, is that people understand how important leadership is. And they understand that the principal sets the tone for everything in a school. And that's just not the teachers telling you, it's not just the principals telling you that, it's the parents and the non-parents as well understand how important it is to have top-notch principals in our schools across the state of ours. Oregonians have great respect for teachers. They hold teachers in high regard. And they want good teachers for their children. And they want to assure that their students, that their children are getting the best teachers possible. And that has come up over and over and over again. Everyone had a story in the focus groups about that teacher who made a difference. And it wasn't just one teacher. It might have been a couple. But you know what else? There was always a story about that one or two or three bad apples as well. And I think that was one of the things that greatly concerned Chalkboard as well, was, you know, what can we do to assure that we have quality educators for our children? Emphasis on reading. They connect the dots. They understand that without being able to read, students are not going to go anywhere later on in their education. And right at the top of the list, you say basics, but there's a basic of the basics, and that's reading. And in Chalkboard's proposals, you'll see a real emphasis on reading because of what public opinion research has said about Oregonians' feelings regarding that issue, but also what John's work shows as well. So it's that building a good foundation for children early on, making sure they're able to read, that Oregonians feel is very important. And here was the issue that I had a hunch was important to folks, but I did not know it was as important as the research showed and continues to show, and that is parental involvement. And it's the parents saying that they feel that they could do more, and we spent time with them. What are the obstacles? What are the handicaps? What's preventing you from becoming more involved in your child's education? But parents and non-parents really felt that parent involvement, more parent involvement, is a real key to moving our system forward. But everyone acknowledges that that's easier said than done, because we spent a lot of time looking at the different obstacles and handicaps out there. And the Chalkboard Project will address some of that and have definitely has identified some things that I think can really go a long ways to improving that situation. So those are some of the highlights, Madam Chair, that really I'm left with when I look at what we've learned regarding quality education. Then accountability. Along comes accountability. Waste and inefficiency, inefficiency and waste and inefficiency. We hear a lot about it. And we hear about it from parents. We hear about it from non-parents. Now, what you quickly learn when you do your quantitative and qualitative research, that there's a lot of misinformation surrounding this issue. But that doesn't mean that people don't feel that there's a lot of waste and inefficiency in the public K-12 system. They do. When you spend some time with them, when you ask them the questions, what you quickly find out is that there is a lot of misinformation out there. Three-quarters of Oregonians, when asked, cannot tell you or feel uncomfortable giving you a percentage of what amount of the school budget goes towards central administration. But darn it, they're convinced that there's waste and inefficiency in the schools. Of those people who are able to give you an estimate, okay, about a quarter of the people, they figure about 34% of the budget of a school district budget goes towards central administration. So that's where you are. And I've seen the figures, and I know there's some disagreement about it, but it isn't any 34%. But that's what we're dealing with relative to awareness and knowledge levels, and that's why a Chalkboard initiative like Open Books is so valuable. And you'll hear more about that. And the big challenge with our Open Books is to get that information out to people. People really are, they want to learn. They haven't dropped the gate on this. That's just where they are right now. They want to learn. They want to know what the real situation is in the schools in Oregon. The final thing I want to say about accountability is, and I see this relative to a lot of public sector agencies, is the use of technology. And there's this perception out there that the public sector generally, including school districts, are not making enough use of technology, and that technology could lead to the more efficient use of resources. And I appreciate all the caveats and the considerations that come along with that kind of statement, but that's where the public is. We see it over and over again. And I found it very interesting to read that Oregon was ranked, I believe, number 3, the state, in e-government. And I think that's a great thing that the state of Oregon should pat its back about. But I'll tell you, you need to see more of that at other levels of government in the state, including school districts. The number of times we heard from parents, for example, why can't I contact my child's teacher in the evenings and send them a message by email, or I can check in and go back and forth with them, because you've got people who are very busy, and if they had that option, it would really allow with what? Parental involvement, right? So some of these issues are very closely related. Parent involvement, the use of technology, teachers being trained to be able to use the technology. We quickly found out that there's a lot of overlap in these issues.
Madam Chair.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. I have a question. When you're talking about technology, then you're talking strictly about technology being used in administration.
Technology, not only in administration, Representative Farr, but also in terms of in the classroom. I heard a reference made to different learning techniques, taking advantage of technology relative to that. I also heard a lot about, again, this form of communication, using technology better to improve communication between teachers in the classroom and parents.
Follow up. Would you include distance learning in?
Absolutely, Representative Farr, I would. Virtual learning, distance learning, these kinds of things, they see their children at their home. Just being able to use technology so well, they're using it in their lives themselves. They're just wondering if it's really being tapped in our K-12 public schools.
Thank you.
Representative Dahl?
Yes, when you talk about technology and in the classroom, is that the is the equipment available and it's an absence of use, or are we short the necessary equipment to implement technological use?
Representative, I really can't comment on that, but I'll tell you, I heard a little of everything. I heard about the equipment is there, but it's outdated. The hardware might be outdated. The software might be outdated. That it's difficult for public school systems, for example, to go through the process and make decisions. And by the time they make a decision to bring in a particular technology, that technology is outdated. Because of how quickly things are taking place. I heard about the technology being available, but the teachers not being trained. In some cases, teachers being resistant to training. I just heard about a lot of different challenges that we have as a state when we look at this issue in detail.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
For the Representative Morgan.
In the discussions that you had with Oregonians, I'm interested in what you got back from parents and people that had children in the system, what their interest was in knowing the quality of the teachers and the administrators and how they wanted to get that information or if they were interested in receiving that kind of information.
Representative Morgan, I can't think of probably anything that's more important for a parent to know than to be assured that their child has a quality teacher in that child's classroom. And a lot of it is a leap of faith right now. There is a great deal of interest in knowing as much as possible about the teacher, about the teacher's background. Right now, they see as how they get that information relatively limited. That it means going to the school, meeting with that person, spending time with that person, and there are a lot of folks that are just being really challenged by not having the time to do that and not having the time to stay on top of those kinds of things. Then we move back to what? How else can they get that kind of information? And by providing that information, maybe at some central place that you can go online to and learn about that person, that person's background, that person's performance record, I think would be greatly appreciated by parents.
Could I have a follow-up, Madam Speaker? I know when my kids were in the K-12 system, which was more than 20 years ago now, the way that we did that was by, as we went in and volunteered in the classrooms and did the parent-teacher kinds of things, you just learned who the effective teachers were. And because we were in the schools, we were able to persuade the administrators to put our kids where we wanted them to
mm-hmm.
be.
Mm-hmm.
And I always always felt that the parents that didn't have that kind of inside edge on the way the system worked, their kids just ended up being in all the other classes. And it doesn't sound from what you're saying that much has changed in that.
I don't think so. I think you've got even one thing, Representative Morgan, that represents a bigger negative now than it did before, and that is there are a lot of teachers that just are feeling pretty overwhelmed right now by a number of things, including the size of their classes. And the thought of more parental involvement, let me put it this way, at best makes them feel nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got that side to deal with as well. Teachers really understand the importance of parental involvement, but they also realize that it takes time, and there are some that feel that they don't have that time right now, that they're under the gun. So, again, a lot of these issues are interconnected.
But again, the application of technology in this area would really be a benefit.
Oh, absolutely. I heard, for example, from parents who said, you know, are there things that I could do for my child's school, for my child's classroom, for my child's teacher, maybe in the evenings? Or the things that maybe I can do on the weekends? And I think it's taking a broader view of what involvement is, when it can be done, making it possible to do some of these things online would all be things that would improve parental involvement, and consequently improve people's attitudes about the K-12 public education system in the state generally.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Adam, I think that what I just heard you say a couple moments ago might underscore what I have heard, and perhaps others anecdotally, in regard to parental involvement, is that sometimes teachers don't want to have to deal with parents who might be presenting themselves to assist in classrooms or whatever. So you obviously have not assessed that, but it's a sense that you're having might be the case in some instances.
Madam Chair, without a doubt, there are teachers who feel that way. They're not only teachers, but they're administrators. I also want to make reference to some, and some of you I know are educators, but I still hear people that, in fact, I just did 4 focus groups dealing with education this past weekend, that just, I ask them, why are you not more involved? And 2 things that we've heard for years, but it's worth remembering. One is, I never am asked.
Mm-hmm.
Just to ask. And if you have people at the school buildings nervous about how do we accommodate this, the ask is not necessarily taking place. The other is just the infrastructure. They drive up, they drop their child off at this school, and it's almost like a wall, a barrier. It's almost like they're uncomfortable. They don't know where to go, how to navigate through that the front of that school building. I think you appreciate what I'm trying to get at here, but there's some of that also going on out there as well. Representative Moore, you might really get a sense of what I'm talking about here in terms of just the discomfort they have going into a school building and navigating around and trying to find who to talk to and all those kinds of things.
Madam Chair.
Well, if I might just comment, Madam Chair, in my district, which is a rural part of the state, there are people that are intimidated by education. They don't feel comfortable.
Sure.
They don't feel worthy
mm-hmm.
to step up and become involved in the system. And so I really understand what you're saying, just the facade of that building.
Right.
Stops them.
Well, you could see, the buses all lined up and all the people in the mornings and all this kind of thing. It's a little threatening to some people. So it's a combination of things, but some pretty, I think there are some things can be done relatively easy to change this. My concern is what's going on in the classrooms and in the buildings to accommodate it, because you want the experiences to be good for the parent and the teacher. And if that's not going to be possible because of a variety of reasons, then this is going to backfire.
Representative Avakian?
Actually, I'll wait. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so what does that bring us to?
Laying that foundation, Adam.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I think one of the issues, too, and I don't know if you got it in your research, is that just like in technology, there also needs to be training for teachers with respect to how to effectively use people who are in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And we haven't done a very good job of that in the past. And I think they feel uncomfortable, the teacher feels uncomfortable, and there's no intermediary that's there helping the two groups get together. And when you have volunteers, when you have good volunteer programs, it's because there are coordinators and there are people who help make
excellent.
That work.
Right. So, and I think I'll remember this from now on, that when I say technology, I'm going to say two other words, and training, because you're absolutely right. It you've got to have both. And I heard about both. We have the technology, but we don't have the training. Or we have the training, and we don't have up-to-date technology.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, may I add to that? I think it's worth noting here that as we've gone along this path and heard these pieces, we've been putting some small grant programs in place. So Chalkboard is giving grants to school districts for technology to establish linkages for parents. We've also been giving grants for a program called Running Start, which is a training program for educators that's designed to help break down the barriers that low-income and minority families feel as they're coming to school. We're just doing train the trainers around that, and we're really encouraged with the response from the education community. There's lots of warm reception to that. And then the third piece is giving grants to districts who are developing local parental involvement policies and trying to have a conversation with the parents in their district around what the expectations are and what the concerns are on both sides. So we think that's a really healthy dialogue to be having, and we're trying to jumpstart that a bit across the state.
Representative Avakian did change his mind.
A couple of the comments prompted me to want to jump in now. It's an interesting discussion based on the information, Mr. Davis, that you're giving us, which is really some polling results and some anecdotal stories from focus groups, a compilation of that with some mingling of potential solutions to the anecdotal stories that you're providing. And because of those potential solutions that are being thrown in, I just want to add 2 cents to that, which is that I think there's the possibility that when parents express concerns about relationships in the school or being intimidated of going in, or when teachers express concerns about, well, how can I handle 4 parent volunteers in the classroom by myself, that doesn't necessarily lead to the conclusion that there's a training or a systems problem in some way, or a technology problem. If you step back 15 years in this state, virtually every classroom had at least one teacher's aide that was responsible for helping with that type of thing. And if you look at the statistics, I think it'll show you have fewer parent volunteers in a lot of districts back then than you do now, and you had decreased class sizes. So part of this problem might not be a training or a technology issue. It might be that we have eliminated much of the support that you used to have in the classroom that you don't have anymore. Right. And so we've created this dynamic for ourselves.
Representative Bakken, I could not agree more. I think that's a big part of this. I think there are a lot of things that are coming together on this issue, but I heard a lot from teachers and principals about that exact issue that you bring up.
And just one other comment, if I might, is that for later, as you go through the presentation, you don't need to comment on it now, but you mentioned a number of times already the generous support that has come from private dollars to schools. We don't do the same thing in our society with other critically important government services like the National Guard, the State Police, the Oregon State Hospital. Yet for some reason, it's okay for us to underwrite much of public education with many, many, many millions of dollars from private foundations. And maybe at some point in your discussion you can talk about whether or not you think that is a healthy thing for Oregon to be relying on, or whether we should be moving in a different direction. And Mr. Davis, that wasn't really directed at you, but just it's come up a number of times, and maybe you can tuck that thought away.
Thank you. Representative Dahlem, and then we will move forward in the sense that we do want to get to those 15 policy recommendations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Adam, I would like a definition, because it seems as though we've confused two terms, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure you'll straighten me out. One is support in the classroom, which implies a volunteer. The other term is parental involvement, which means the parent, their child, and the teacher. So when you did your survey, are those two terms distinguished, and are we mixing them a tad here?
We have a danger of mixing them, Representative Allen. I'm glad you brought that up. But parental involvement is broader than just going to the schools and putting some time in the classroom. In fact, that's a relatively small part of parental involvement overall. I learned a lot about how that kind of involvement drops off by the time that child gets to middle school and high school. But parental involvement can continue by the kind of support that parent gives that child at home, the encouragement that that parent gives. That is what people are talking about in the broader sense, Representative Dell. That classroom work, generally I heard most about that for younger children at K through 5 maybe, and then it was just great to hear the conversations how, you know, my children really don't want to see me around past a certain age, and so parents understand, and non-parents do, that it takes different forms, and some of those forms are more important as you move on with your child.
Okay. Funding.
Thank you.
Funding, real quick. One of your favorite topics here. Don't want to miss that one. It's real. None of you should be surprised that we continue to find a very divided state over this issue. A lot of people think it's about using money more wisely. Other people think no. We need additional funds for K through 12 education. The latter group, I'll tell you, I've spent a lot of time with them, and there is quite candidly, I must tell you that it doesn't take much. I talk about accountability for those people to change their opinions and feel that they've got to be assured that certain things are happening before they're going to sign up for more money for the K through 12 education system. There's a lot of skepticism on the part of Oregonians about funding measures. They will tell you when we survey them that they really would like to see if there is more money for public K through 12 education, a mix of different sources than any one particular source. I think the point here about local option changes, a lot of concern there. A yellow flag goes up for people, and they just wonder if this is not a back door into more taxes. So you'll see these recommendations recommendations related to these issues as we go on this morning. I want to make very quick reference to a couple things. We tested all the different proposals that you will be seeing this morning, that Sue and John will be reviewing with you, and all of them enjoy support on the part of the public. I want to conclude very quickly by saying when we go out there and talk to people about Chalkboard, there is a lot of support for the direction Chalkboard is taking. And it's interesting to see what the reasons are. One is that they're viewed as not the traditional stakeholders, some new people at the table on an issue that they feel very strongly about. They appreciate the nonprofit, nonpartisan nature of chalkboard. They like the statewide focus, especially when you get outside of the Portland area and the Willamette Valley. That's very important, but also impresses people in Portland and the Willamette Valley. We might be cynical, and we sometimes wonder about the value, but the public is very appreciative of the chalkboard project reaching out and constantly to ask the public what it feels about these issues. And finally, they're interested in supporting an effort that they feel there's some long-term commitment behind. And those are all things that the chalkboard project stands for. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm finished.
Thank you, Representative Rowland.
One just quick question.
Sure.
On the funding issue, were there any regional differences? Because you did look at all the stuff from a regional perspective as well as statewide. With regard to those conclusions?
There were some regional differences.
You want to explain that?
I knew that was coming. Real quickly, it does vary by the people. The one thing that really struck me is the Oregon coast and how people on the Oregon coast, people in those school districts, really are concerned. Representative Rollin, about those school districts, and they're more likely to feel that part of the solution is more money. That was the real standout for me. The connectedness people have in rural Oregon with their schools is different than the connectedness that people have with their schools in more urbanized areas. And I would say that there might be some difference also by rural and non-rural on this issue as well, with rural people being a little bit more supportive.
Adam, is that information available that you might be able to provide us, or is it in our documentation?
I don't think it's in your documentation, but we sure could pull something together for you on that.
Submit that to Mr. Keller.
Okay, excellent.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, out of Adam's work, Adam's work represents one part of what Chalkboard has done. And you might hear people say, well, Chalkboard's trying to build policy on public opinion. We're not, but we think it's an important place to start, and that's why we went deeply. And out of Adam's work, there was a key question that was asked across the state. What do you think are the top barriers to successful schools? And from that, this list emerged. Not enough direct parental support. Lack of stable and adequate funding, not attracting and retaining highly qualified teachers, unfunded mandates. Interesting, we thought that ranked pretty high on the list. And then perceived central administration waste and inefficiency. We took the answer to that question, and these were all very high numbers, 80% range, and we used that to really guide our academic research. We had to focus that researcher. We could have been at this for 10 years looking at all kinds of wonderful, promising practices, but that was the focus we used to overlay the academic research. We also stepped back and said, where are we today? What is the condition of Oregon's K-12? And we have put out one report, and we've just updated it. And I'd like to ask John to come up and share with you the quick answers to that question of where do we stand today. And then we want to talk about what we found in the research.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, Madam Speaker, members of the committee, I'm John Taponia. I'm a managing director of Echo Northwest, a Portland-based economic consulting firm, and have consulted to the Chalkboard Project for 2 years now on looking at educational best practices, education finance, and related matters. In terms of where Oregon stands now, we produced in January of 2005 a report that's on the Chalkboard website called The Condition of Oregon K-12 Education. And in that, attempted to find every comparator that would allow one to compare Oregon's achievement to the achievement of students in other states, and in some cases in other nations if it were possible. With math and science scores, you're able to do that. And the summary goes like this. We do good but not great, in particular when you're looking at comparisons of the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the so-called Nation's Report Card. Oregon overall tends to score about average when you compare all Oregon students to all students in other states. But there is some interesting complexity to that. If you peel away what makes Oregon students different from students in different states, and you start to compare subpopulations of Oregon students to subpopulations in other states. For example, on some of those NAEP tests, while we may look average, if you compare white students to white students in other states, our white students underperform on some of those NAEP exams relative to white students in other states. There's at least one test that I can think of where our black students outperform black students in other states. In the most recent testing for 2005 in the NAEP, there were a number of tests where our Hispanic students underperform relative to Hispanics in other states. If you look at it geographically, our central city students, if you look at it as central city versus central city, routinely outperform central city students in other states, but that's not surprising because the characteristics of our central cities are considerably different than the characteristics of Detroit, St. Louis, Philadelphia, you name them. Our rural students in the most recent 2005 exam appear to underperform relative to rural students on a number of tests, and that actually changed a little bit relative when we looked at the 2003 to the 2005 test. There were a couple of additional reading and math tests that popped up as having a statistical difference when you made that comparison. And then also another interesting finding that we found is that you can also compare our low-income students, as indicated by their participation in free and reduced-price lunch, to low-income students in other states. There are a number of tests where generally we students in that category in Oregon overperform relative to like students in other states. But on the other side, the students who are not eligible for free and reduced, so middle and upper income, are underperforming relative to the non. And so consequently, we have a smaller achievement gap when you look at it in terms of socioeconomic low income versus high income, but that is driven by two factors. Our lower income students appear to be overachieving relative to their peers, and our higher income students appear to be underachieving somewhat relative to their peers, which obviously narrows the gap, but not necessarily in the way you'd want it to be narrowed. You'd want the lower folks to be gaining on the higher income folks. So we also have not. I don't think this is news to anyone here as well. This higher than average class sizes in Oregon, and that has increased the trend. We are moving toward the tail of the distribution in that respect. We have had historically, but are improving in terms of dropout rates, and there are a lot of complexities and difficulties in terms of how one measures that, but certainly there's been improvement there, but historically Oregon was high on that. The absentee issue is one that has consistently both intrigued and puzzled us to some degree. What we have found in whenever standardized tests, like the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or even there's an International Science and Math test are given, those tests are given to a random selection of schools and students. And when those tests are administered, they will do a survey of the school official or a school official in that school to characterize the conditions of the school. And consistently, and we've seen it across three or four different tests like that, officials in Oregon schools are more likely to highlight a problem with absenteeism than officials in schools in other states. It's also consistent with another piece of information that, as reported by the Department of Education to the National Center on Education Statistics, our average daily attendance compared to our average daily membership, which is sort of an enrollment number, tends to be lower. And some of that can just be accounting, but if you look at those two pieces of information together, while neither is perfect, I think it points to an issue that Oregon needs to pay attention to and needs to get its mind wrapped around. And that's sort of our point on that one. And then we do have a high teacher turnover rate, which was highlighted in our original 2005 report and was certainly a main focus of the teacher quality workforce and task force and their recommendations.
Representative Roblin has a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Two, actually. The first one has to do with length of the school year, number of days in school. Did you do any comparison with our state and other states with regard to the total number of days of instruction?
That that gets a little tricky in that our mandate is an hour-based mandate over the course of the year as opposed to a day-based mandate. But no specific comparisons that I have.
And did you compare the procedural expectation with respect to attendance from one state to the other? You know, our state has put an emphasis on that for a long time, and period-by-period attendance, a whole lot of things that we stress more than other states in the past. And I wondered if that is, if you looked at any of that with regard to the absentee data.
That's an area that we need to delve in more deeply. The one piece that I think we have identified and that we can't agree on is that there is no uniform regulation passed down by the state to the school districts on how attendance must be taken. Some other states have that. And so you can have sort of a passive or an active attendance framework. It's sort of like the proven until not, well, in any event, you can have a system where a child is presumed to be absent or presumed to be absent until found present, or vice versa.
Right.
And so one of the recommendations that we made early on is that there needs to be some thought about that at the Department of Education in terms of formulating, understanding what districts are doing now, and understanding whether there's a best practice that could be disseminated.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back a little bit to the class size issue, and I was cruising your website, and I have done that a lot because it is a really valuable resource. I've been especially interested in the Open Book Project, and just as an aside, commend you for putting that information out there in the public sector. I think that's real important. But what I came across was something that said the top 10 things you need to know about Oregon's public schools. I just printed that out. And the seventh thing was really interesting to me. It says, well, spending on instruction and salaries and benefits measured on a per-student basis are close to the national average. Salaries and benefit costs per staff are significantly above the national average since Oregon employs relatively few staff. Spending on other support services is also well above the national average. And can you talk to us about what other support services are? What did you
right.
find when you looked at that?
That's a specific accounting category that is defined by the National Center on Education Statistics, other support services. And they consist of sort of the back office business operations of the district, which could include developing the payroll, procurement, warehousing, and activities of that sort. That is a finding. Our finding there is consistent with the finding that the Secretary of State made in an audit that was conducted in 2002 and then ultimately followed up with some recommendations from the Secretary of State. But that is an area, the other support services, that has consistently shown a difference in terms of spending per student in Oregon versus the national average and Oregon versus nearby states, and is one that has led to one of the key efficiency recommendations that Chalkboard is going to advance around performance audits. It's very difficult to stand back as a researcher and say, well, I've identified this difference, but the difference and what is driving it is marbled into the activities of 198 different districts, and what is driving it in one district may not be the issue in another district. And so the idea there, and we can get into more detail later, is that sharp business minds, both from stakeholders and from the business community, should get together, develop a list of best practices that would then be checked for and audited for at local districts, and give them assistance to implement them to drive savings.
Thank you.
And John, in regard to the class size, to inform our consideration, you stated the Oregon class size is higher than the national average. And can you give us the figure then? The average class size in the state of Oregon is assumed to be.
We have it in the conditions report. I'm always a little skeptical personally about class size, because it can it's difficult. Or student-teacher ratios, who's a teacher, who's not, if is a teacher in the classroom, is a teacher not.
Right.
What's more reliable from my perspective, although, and entirely consistent with the class size notion, is simply to count up all of the adults that are working in the system, all the staff. And Oregon is consistently also at the tail of the distribution in terms of the number of staff that are employed relative to the number of students. That being, there are relatively few adults, relatively few employees in the K-12 endeavor as a whole relative to other states. And so what, in essence, the easiest way to understand this is that historically Oregon was in and around the average in terms of spending per student. Through the most recent state fiscal crisis and a slowing and in some cases no growth in a couple of years in terms of spending per student, we have now slipped down to be somewhat below average in spending per student. But we're in that middle area.
Madam Chair.
We are in that middle area, and that is driven by two extremes. We have relatively few staff working in the system, but the staff are, relative to other states, above average compensated. The salaries per staff member are about average. The benefit spending per staff member is above average, and that is to some degree driven by the 6% pickup that some districts have. It is also driven by health insurance costs and the regular cost of PERS as well.
One moment. I have a series here, and reminding members that we do want to get to that list of 15 policy recommendations or concepts, and so I have Representative Dahlem, Representative Bakken, and then Representative Gelson.
When you talk about compare Oregon to others in class size, I would be more interested in comparing Oregon to best practices. At one time, the best practice for kindergarten was 12, first grade was 14, something like that. Is that research available on, and it seems like the loading after you went to a certain number, put in 1,000, because it doesn't make any difference anymore. And is that, are those numbers available?
That lies at the heart of one of Chalkboard's key recommendations around class size, where the best practices research, the best that is available as of today, would suggest that class size can make a difference in kindergarten and first grade, vis-a-vis the studies in Tennessee and Wisconsin and follow-up studies that have evaluated those efforts.
And when you say best practices, you're talking about evidence-based and research and mm-hmm. those things that have been accomplished somewhere and showed demonstrable positive results.
Right, through a rigorous experimental design where students have been randomly assigned to one practice versus another. That was the case in the Tennessee Star class size experiment from the 80s. Or through sort of rigorous, what you'd call quasi-experimental designs, where economists try to control for all the other factors that could be affecting a change in achievement. But those studies have been repeated over and over again, and people eventually say, okay, well, that wasn't randomized, and it's not as perfect as an experiment, but now we've seen this 15 or 20 times in different places, and so we are going to conclude that intervention certainly shows promise if implemented. Correct.
Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, that answered one of the specific questions I was going to ask, but as you present your information and as other groups come in to present information to us, The comparison to other states is an interesting thing, but since education is hurting in virtually all of the 50 states, I don't find it particularly helpful in guiding us on where we need to go. And so the notion of best practices, or I even think of it more in terms of just what does a kid need, what kind of an environment does the kid need in order to learn best, that type of information is more helpful to me than a comparison between us and other states that may have a better or a worse situation than us.
I think that's mostly comment. Did you wish to reply?
You can see where Oregon stands in a context, and I agree with that. The point I would make relative to your comment is that I believe the situation the legislature is in is like this, and that perhaps for the first time in 6 or 7 years, there may be resources available to invest beyond the so-called current service level, potentially. And the question that I think research needs to answer is, are there practices that show a higher probability of success in driving achievement than others? Mm-hmm. Bottom line is, where do your marginal dollars show the best hope of driving achievement and moving you toward or potentially beyond those other states that you're looking at?
And Representative Lavakian, I think we all agree that our whole focus is what do children need to learn and how can we best accommodate that? So would you agree?
I wasn't implying that we didn't feel that
right way,
but just that as information, there'll be a lot of information coming into this committee. And a lot of states have tried a lot of different things, and knowing how we rank with respect, as an example, you brought up the Tennessee study, which is a great study for us to look at and consider. At the same time, Tennessee is selling out the sides of their school buses to private businesses for advertising in order to raise money. So there are other dynamics going on in Tennessee that make it difficult for us to do a state-by-state comparison on how well we are doing here. You follow me? And so the substantive information about how to best raise children, I just think is most helpful. That was just, and you're
getting some of that. Thank you, and it's very appreciated. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In relation to the cost of salary and benefits in comparison to other states, I was wondering what year that data came from and if it took into account PERS reform, and specifically how our health care costs stack up across other states.
On that specific comparison that I just made was from 2002-03, which would have been the school year immediately preceding the PERS reform. The way that the accounting is going to work and the cost of the system, the benefit cost will actually increase in PERS as we pay down the unfunded liabilities of the past. Now, that's going to be associated with staff who are no longer in the system. So PERS costs will rise in the near term before they decline, and ultimately you get the full impact of a transition to OPSERP, the successor plan. With respect to health care, the finance work group also found that Oregon's spending on health insurance is higher than the K-12 public average for the nation. Looking at Bureau of Labor Statistics findings, we found that Oregon is spending on health insurance something equal to roughly 20% of its salary cost on health insurance. The national average is about 14% for K-12 public schools.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I ask if you have that same information relative to the retirement benefits, recognizing that the retirement benefits that are in the data are lower than the ones we're going to be working with. What percentage of salary is the average for retirement benefits, and what percentage is Oregon's percentage?
I don't have that one off the top of my head, but it is one that we can estimate. But the other point that I think needs to be made is as we move forward, while the costs of that retirement system will be in the K-12 system and have to be paid, you will need to draw a clear distinction between the K-12 system paying for those and what the staff who are currently working in the system will be actually receiving at that point in time, because there will be costs borne by the K-12 system in these upcoming years that really don't relate to people that are in the system anymore. And so those, mm-hmm. while the costs are real and will have to be dealt with, the compensation of staff, the staff aren't going to feel that. The staff on the ground are not going to feel like they're better compensated because of those.
But I still think that the extent of the challenge that we face in that area would be clarified somewhat if we had those percentage comparisons.
Mr. Keller, if you would follow up with Mr. Toponia and get that information for the committee. Thank you. Further questions? I think we're going to move forward.
All right. We have quite a ways to go, so I'm going to move through these.
Kind of like seeing any objection, seeing none.
Move through this part quickly. 2 years ago, the Chalkboard project engaged Echo Northwest to do as broad a review of K-12 best practices as was conceivable within time and budget constraints. But you know, from the perspective of someone who's worked for the U.S. Congressional Budget Office, where I had to work for both the House and the Senate and Republicans and Democrats and had to be objective or I would be in big trouble in that environment, this truly was an objective, open, intellectually curious endeavor on the part of these foundations. They literally said, look, we want you to look from end to end, and we want to know in whatever category they are how much we know about practices that would move Oregon up the list and to the top of the list on achievement. So we went with that broad mandate into a very deep literature review. And if you go on Chalkboard's website, there's one report in particular called Improving Quality and Driving Accountability. I think it is more than 200 pages long. And it has 13 chapters and goes through almost every topic you could imagine. We went through one round. We thought it was comprehensive. They then come back and said, well, wait a minute, you didn't address X, Y, and Z. And so we went back and filled those pieces out. So it was comprehensive. One of the pieces that I had to come back to them early on with was, why are there so few what one would call proven best practices, as the chair alluded to, practices that have been demonstrated through rigorous experimental or multiple quasi-experimental designs, and that researchers are comfortable saying, if you invest in this, you can expect this type of achievement outcome. These are the perspectives of a couple of groups that have tried to address why there are so few. The first, the Coalition of Evidence-Based Policy, which was pulled together by the Department of Education, simply expressing their frustration. And then Eric Hanischek from Stanford University, and I think Professor Hanischek's perspective is more along the lines of there's such a constellation of teaching styles and learning styles that it is difficult from a state level to identify a practice that is going to fit all of those possible combinations. From the other side of the argument, the Coalition of Evidence-Based Policy, their argument would be research, that we simply haven't invested in research in the way that we need to understand this. If you look at the medical profession and you think of drug studies with placebos, we routinely do randomized studies there to understand precisely what the impacts and the side effects of a drug are. We have multiple studies on that. Even in the welfare to work area, we've done a remarkable amount of work on, if you put somebody into this type of training program or job readiness program and you don't put them, you know, you take another sample of folks and you don't put them in. There's lots of research in welfare to work and employment training. for whatever reason, and it may be that people are just less comfortable using children in randomized controlled experiments, we don't have nearly as many studies in K-12 as we do in those other areas. So as we went into the research, we considered it in two broad buckets. The first I would consider the resource and input-based strategies, and this is one that I would consider the QEM and QEM-related proposals to fall in. And the basic argument there is, look, the system as it exists and has existed in recent years is essentially essentially efficient and in a good form. What is missing are inputs and more resources into that system, and you could enumerate however many of them and different levers that you could change. And so that is one major line of argument. Another line of argument would be, well, no, your system that you have set there is inefficient in its nature. And what it lacks is our sort of competitive influences, that it needs more market and incentive-based influences built into it. And so consequently, proposals like vouchers or more charter schools, changing compensation for teachers, things of that nature fall into that change of philosophy, change of system. And so we looked at both of those, and if you go back to that 200-page report, you'll see that we sort of broke our report into those two major buckets. So what do we know on the resource-based side? That is more or less the incumbent system, and the one that has been studied more. And the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy, that same group that I alluded to, in 2003, they essentially went through all the literature and tried to identify what they believed the policies were that rose to the level of best practices, because they had either gone through an experiment or had been validated through so many different studies that they were comfortable making that assertion. The first being one-on-one tutoring by qualified tutors for at-risk readers in grades 1-3, based in part on the Success for All model out of Johns Hopkins University, but then other related models as well that had been studied and repeatedly demonstrated to be effective. Reducing class size in the early grades, also vis-a-vis the Tennessee Star and also Wisconsin, and then other quasi-experimental studies of class size differentials. Sort of curriculum-based approaches, life skills training for junior high students to reduce smoking and substance abuse also made their list, and then phonemic awareness and phonics training for young readers rounded out their list of four. But that, as of 2003, were the four that made their list. On the market and incentive-based strategy side, suffers from the same, in essence, the same problem that the resource base does to some degree, but suffers more so because most of those market incentive-based strategies are relatively new. Vouchers have been tried in Wisconsin and Cleveland and Florida and other places. They have been studied. One study will come out arguing that it had impacts for certain students in certain circumstances, and you'll see a counter study that will say that will come after its method. But the number of them have been so few and the experience so recent that none from the perspective of researchers has risen to the definitive best practice and invest in this approach, implement this approach, and you will get this outcome. Charter schools, same issue. They only started in the early 90s in Minnesota. They're certainly growing and people are watching them, but to this point researchers have not been able to disentangle whether participation in a charter school is driving achievement relative to participation in more traditional schools. So with that,
So where does that bring us to? So we've looked at our public opinion pieces. You've heard from John what we the approach we took to the research, and frankly, we wish there were more gold standards. We, when John came back and shared what he had, we had to loosen our sieve and then say, go find us the promising practices. So what you'll be hearing about in our proposals, some are gold standards, some are more promising, and some we don't have a lot of data on at all. We just have a lot of anecdotal interest in them. On the back of the timeline I mentioned earlier is the action plan that we put out in June of 2005. And I just want to remind you that in the yellow box there, you'll see the issues where we felt we needed to dig deeper. So we had John's research, we had Adam's research, but we needed to hear from practitioners. So for quality educators, we convened a working group, really a stakeholder process, where we had the schools of education, public and private, the unions, COSA, OSBA, a frontline teacher, a charter school administrator, principal. And that group met for 6 months and really worked through for us issues around the profession. How do we strengthen teacher quality? How do we attract and retain highest quality educators? We also formed a group on funding. Jim Scherzinger chaired that for us. That was an expert group. John sat on that group, as did others, Nancy Heiligman, Paul Warner, Brian Reeder, some business folks, Paul Kelly and others. And they were not to give us really consensus recommendations. They were to look at the finance issues, equity, adequacy, stability, transparency, and give us their best plan for going forward for Oregon. So that group also met for 6 months. And between the two groups, we had 65 recommendations last March. Lots of good ideas, all of which are on our website. We sifted those based on two things. What would raise student achievement? And what were the leverage points for change? And out of that 65, we picked 13 recommendations, which you'll hear about today. Those are the ones we put back out to Oregonians. We asked them to comment on for another four-month period. We held meetings across the state around those. We got lots of input. We had an exhaustive website survey process where people could look at those 13 and all the others and weigh in on those. So what we're going to share with you today is sort of the refinements of where we are with this action plan. I think the proposals fall mainly into four buckets: educator and administrator quality, early age investments, business efficiencies, and funding issues. And what we'd like to do is walk through each one of those buckets and share with you, first of all, a slide that really focuses on what is the problem we're trying to solve, and then give you our thoughts on what's come forth from the process. So first, looking at quality educators, you've heard from Adam how much Oregonians revere teachers and want to make sure that they have the supports that they need. I think really here we're looking at both supports for professionals as well as accountabilities. So these are some of the issues we are trying to address. First of all, we know that having a highly qualified teacher in every classroom and a highly qualified administrator in every school is a goal that we want to aspire to for Oregon. We also know we have 37% of our teachers leaving the profession in their first 5 years in the classroom. That's about where the national average is, but we think that's a pretty high attrition rate. The cost to Oregon, to the best that we can estimate, is about $45 million per year to replace those professionals who are leaving. And while in the past Oregon has had the wisdom of putting a statewide mentor program in place, we haven't been able to fund it for some time. And so we don't have any statewide effort really addressing those new teachers and new administrators. So in looking at the proposals that have come forth from our process, really there are four. The first is to resurrect that program, to have a mentor for every new teacher and every new administrator for their first 3 years in the classroom or in the school. We think we have good research that shows us that has paid dividends in other states, and that would reduce that attrition rate. We also have a proposal around professional development. We want to ensure that educators are taking professional development coursework that ties directly to student achievement goals in their school. So we see every school having a professional development plan that's built around their student achievement goals and making sure every educator's coursework relates to those goals. A secondary piece here is around quality control of professional development. We have learned that there is no rigorous review of professional development offerings or any kind of accreditation process of what is available. And we think that that's something the state ought to look at least a review, so that we can ensure that dollars going into professional development are buying high-quality programs. The next piece, which came from our working group.
Excuse me, before you go on, I think we have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, I see where the 37% leaving. Our goal was not zero. We should not have zero, right? I mean, we want to have new people coming in through the system and cleaning it up. So I'm sure that you talked about that or discussed that. Is that correct, that the goal is not zero?
Well, the goal is to make sure they're not all leaving in their first years of teaching, that they have the supports they need in those early difficult years to learn their classroom management skills and really navigate through that. I think that's the concern, is that so much of that is happening in those early years in the classroom.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Yeah, again, I agree with that, but I don't want to kind of get in trouble here, wasn't it? A lot of the teachers are females that will leave to have children and want to maybe come back later, right? Is that looked at? And is that?
I think your
families to have families.
Your original point that the goal is not zero is an appropriate one. There's always going to be within the first 5 years some individuals that, regardless of the level of support, are going to recognize that for whatever reason that profession is not right for them. Driving it to zero is not the goal.
I have one more to try to get me out of trouble here.
I'll help you if you like.
Thank you. I still think, I mean, do some of those people, they leave to start a family and they come back. Is that true?
They would be in that statistic, yes.
Okay.
I think there is a lot of historical truth to the fact that education has been dominated by women and for various reasons over the decades and centuries. And so perhaps we'll just leave that with a period and move forward. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professional development, does that relate to continued training after the teacher is in place? Mm-hmm. I'm curious then if where we are in relation to national average was with retention. Is that something that really jumped out at you, that we are really not doing a good job of retention when you look at what the other states are doing?
We're about at the national average.
Okay. So what was the discussion then around the way that we train teachers here in relation to how teachers are trained in states where the retention is more successful?
Mm-hmm. We had a lot of discussion around that, and the schools of education, both private and public, were part of those discussions. And I think that that whole piece really needs to be looked at deeply. I think that our group sort of dealt with it on the surface and did not go deeply there because of the time constraints we had. But everybody agreed that's a piece where there needs to be more accountability about the level of training the educator has coming out of that system and going into the classroom. I think our folks felt that that wouldn't replace, however, the idea of a master teacher mentoring a new teacher in their early days. You know, even if we had a stronger outcome from the training process, we would still want to have that mentorship program in place.
Thank you.
Speaker Minnis.
One of the anecdotes I hear in my world is new teachers coming in, their level of pay is very low. And you know, once you're there and established, then the pay increases. Does that have an impact or in your research? Did you see that was a factor? Is that not a factor?
I think we saw that is a factor, and that sort of leads to the last piece on our list, which is we want to look at different options for how we pay teachers. And one of the things that Chalkboard is proposing is that we work with districts who voluntarily want to look at some of those options of moving away from the seniority-based pay system and allowing some flexibility to do more with entering teachers or teachers going into high-need areas. Would be one of the goals of that piece.
It's also been relayed to me, you know, first of all, I want to make sure when I ask these questions, please don't read anything into what I'm asking. This is an attempt by me to try to get good information. And I hope while I'm on the subject, that this committee understands we all have our points of view on this subject, but the point of this committee is to take an honest look at what the struggles, what are the challenges we have in education in this state. I hope this does not turn into a partisan or adversarial exchange on this committee. This committee was formed to take an honest look at what education, what are the challenges, and I think both sides are probably going to hear things that make them a little uncomfortable, and I hope that as we go through this process that we kind of put our other points of view on the shelf and take in what we hear and not be afraid to ask questions that perhaps don't make people very comfortable. But the other thing I've heard is, you know, in deliberating how those dollars are assigned to personnel. You know, they'll bargain for a lot of money for the seniority teachers and then be willing to cut loose some of the new folks. And it's just how it is. It's not, and I don't know if my understanding that is accurate, and perhaps we're going to get into that down the road a little bit, but. You know, do those kinds of practices have an effect on the morale of the new teachers? And if they see that their compensation is very low going in and pretty generous going out, how that impacts our ability to retain them and keep them in the classroom?
Well, we hear anecdotal pieces of that. I don't think we can go beyond the anecdotes that we hear. But again, that is part of why we want to have the conversation about what alternatives could look like to the seniority-based salary structure. And let me say a word about that. This is an area where the research isn't very deep. And so for Chalkboard's purposes, we think this is an area where we ought to put all our dollars on the table and see if there are any districts who are interested in looking at this. And we are pursuing this actually tomorrow with an information conference we're holding down in Eugene. We've invited every superintendent and their local association president and their school board members, anybody who's interested, to come and learn with us for a day what other states are doing in this area. So we've invited speakers from all over the country who are coming to talk about what's happening in their states. We've invited teachers, and we have 60 school districts who are going to be participating. And there's a real mix of some of the, I think 16 of the 20 largest districts are coming, a lot of rural, smaller districts. And we're going to listen tomorrow. We're going to learn together and then figure out if there's interest in voluntary pilots. But I think those are the kinds of issues that can be explored if we can open the conversation there. And one side point about that, one of the things that encouraged us to do that was not only that the public interest was high in it, but that the federal government has recently set up a $100 million fund to encourage voluntary experiments and alternatives to the salary structure as well. So we thought we saw some momentum and that Oregon ought at least be having the conversation.
Thank you.
Representative Dahlin, Representative Farr, Representative Roblin, and then Representative Gelder, and then Sue, you and I are going to have to talk about how we're going to proceed here and perhaps manage our time even if we need to move into the afternoon.
I would like some information. We talk about 37% of the teachers leaving the profession. I'd like to know if you have the information, how does that compare with other professionals that carry the a comparable amount of education? Do we have 37% of the first-year attorneys leaving the profession? I mean, that would give us some sense of what we might anticipate under a normal turnover.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We can follow up with that for you, Representative Collins.
Yes. That's an interesting comparison, mm-hmm. attorneys, teachers.
Yeah. We haven't looked at that deeply, but we can do that.
I just have a really quick question, Sue. You know, you were talking about new teachers and the retention, so I just wondered, was there any correlation between higher need districts and their ability to retain teachers versus districts that, you know, may have a different level of student performance?
Well, again, we think that's an area where there's some promising practices around the salary piece, you know, paying higher salaries or incentives to attract teachers into high-need schools and high-need subject matters. So that's an area where we would like to experiment in the pilot process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Actually, now because of that, about three little quick questions.
Okay.
The first one from you was that in the 1970s and 80s, there were some some research done, I'm not sure how good it was, on that retention issue with regard to asking people who left why they left. And it coincided with effective schools research that had to do with the structure of the school, the leadership of the administration, and other things were some of the key reasons for leaving, as opposed they knew what to do when they went into the school, and there were systems in place to help them. And those that didn't have it had a lot of people leaving. The other issue is there's a number of rural schools that paid high at the beginning of the salary schedule to attract teachers, but then after they were there for a couple of years, they left because they went to other school districts. So the compensation issue, I think, is another one we can look at, even in our own state over years, as to whether that worked. It may have got them in, but it may not have kept them.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had some of those issues in rural Oregon a lot. And we became a training grounds for a whole lot of other places because we'd pay high early and then they couldn't pay level. And I think it would be worth looking at some of that, too. That's just comments.
Oh, no, I thought you said you had three.
Well, I thought that was the third one, but that was okay.
Okay, well then.
Well, you are doing a leadership issue later, so I'll either that one later.
Yeah. Representative Gelder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got two. One was, in terms of the retention of teachers, was there any correlation between the entry-level pay for those new teachers and when they turned over? I know in our school district we do have some teachers that start, first-year teachers that have families that actually are eligible for food stamp benefits, mm-hmm. and I wondered, kind of building on what Speaker Minnis had spoken about, if that's a disincentive for people to stay in the system and move up the salary ladder.
Again, I think, Representative Gelser, we've got anecdotal evidence about that.
Great. And my second follow-up. My not really a follow-up, but it's a second question. In terms of the new ways of paying educators and the merit-based pay, were you able to locate research or best practices from other parts of the country that were able to tie those alternative salary structures to teacher retention and student outcomes mm-hmm. and achievement?
It's really an emerging area of research. The best example we have is a program called the Teacher Advancement Program, the TAP program, which is funded by the Milken Foundation and which is in place now, I think, in 7 states. And their early returns, we've been looking particularly at their schools in Minnesota, are raising student achievement and are raising student growth. So that's one of the encouraging pieces. But I want to make it very clear, the research is not deep here, and that's why Chalkboard is not calling for any kind of statewide change here. We are calling for pilot programs with districts who want to explore that. And we're bringing the TAP folks out tomorrow to talk about their successes. We're also bringing in Minnesota. They have gone to a statewide incentive program called QComp. But even their returns are pretty early in the process. So I don't think there's a lot of depth here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The next piece for us, and we'll move as rapidly as we can here.
Now, just as a word of caution, we do need to either recess or adjourn by noon for another emergency committee meeting, some of us. And if you suspect that we will be done by noon, then that's fine, and this is your determination and the availability of the committee, or if you think we need to adjourn and reconvene. So I'll let you best monitor that.
Okay, Madam Chair. I think we can finish by noon.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to quality early education initiatives. John's already talked about what the problem is here that we're trying to solve, which is the class size piece, and also students who aren't reading by the end of third grade. We know how critical that is, and we want to make sure we've got as many supports in place as possible to make sure that our third graders are reading well. So the proposals here really fall into two buckets. First, class size reduction, and John talked about the Tennessee research. We think it's very compelling. So one of the proposals is to reduce class sizes in kindergarten and first grade to 15 students a class. The second is to augment that with reading tutors, to have tutors for any child who isn't reading at grade level in K-3. And our proposal considers doing that either through paid tutors or through voluntary programs, Reading First, SMART programs. There are some other ways to do that. We think those two pieces have the most compelling research around them about actually raising student achievement. We think the dollars invested there would move Oregon student achievement, and John's going to speak to that specifically. The second approach there is to look at full-day kindergarten and look at what we can do around middle and high school. We don't have good answers around middle and high school right now, and we've looked at this deeply, and we have a lot of emerging practices. Debbie Craig mentioned small schools. That's an example of an emerging practice, but we did not feel the research points us to a specific intervention at those two grade levels that is worthy of the same investment that we see in the early grade levels. So what we've done is put a placeholder in our proposals. We've used the QEM numbers around middle and high school reforms and built that into our finance model. I really would be waiting for the research to ripen there. The one area where I think we could invest now there would be principal leadership coaching and training. We all know how important that is. We see that as a piece of our professional development proposals.
Madam Chair, one question regarding the research.
Representative Buckin.
Thank you. With regard to the full-day kindergarten, did you also consider studies regarding pre-kindergarten Head Start, or the effect on restoration of music, art, and physical education programs as factors separate from full-day kindergarten?
I point you to the 200-plus page report that I referred to earlier. There's an entire chapter on pre-kindergarten, and I believe it was the position of Chalkboard as they came in that this was a K-12 focus. And that research is in there, and there is encouraging research in pre-K that is in that Chalkboard report. But again, the focus was K-12.
Thank you.
With respect to full day, half day, why don't we go to that slide and then come back to the other one? What full day versus half day doesn't have that class size in the early grades does is that rigorous Tennessee study and the Wisconsin study to fall back on. While the full day, half day literature is mixed and probably leaning positive, there are still recent reports that have come out where you've got folks from USC, Cannon et al., and Rand saying that they don't believe it's that those earnings gains or achievement gains in kindergarten persist beyond first grade, yet you have others and one down at the University of Oregon who believes it's promising. So still some back and forth on that topic and not as solidified, we would argue, as the K-1 research. So now I'll flip back to the K-1, and one of the frequently asked questions is, well, I mean, the Tennessee Star did K-3. California picked up kindergarten third grade class reductions based on that. Why only K-1? Looking at that literature closely, and there's a lot of debate about Project Star in Wisconsin and what worked and didn't work and whether randomization was done correctly or not. But one of the features that is where there's an increasing consensus is that it does appear that the gains that were made out of those projects were gained primarily in kindergarten and first grade. They were maintained in second and third grade, but they were not added to. And they don't fully understand why that is, but they think in part it is because, and I know one because I'm a father of one, kindergartners are not socialized to sit in chairs and rows or even circles. And so the more disruption potential there is in those very early years, the less learning time there is. And so the fewer kids you have in that group, the lower is the probability you're going to have disruption to shut down the learning process. That's one of the theories. And the second theory is that sort of an inoculation early in that sort of gets these kids on track up to speed in reading, and that carries on and is not built on or added to in second and third grade in the same fashion. The debate's not over, but that's sort of where the debate is leading at this point.
Is there anything in your research that indicates that in the class size reduction models that is connected to other reforms that might be taking place within the education structure that would support?
Well, certainly all of the quality education reforms in terms of quality educators are absolutely critical. This class size reductions will not work by themselves unless there are quality educators to implement them. And that was the major lesson of California's implementation of K-3 class size reductions. They spent over $1 billion a year to very quickly and abruptly reduce class sizes in kindergarten through third grade. What they ended up doing is having to triple their hiring of teachers in a single year. They had teachers on waivers that weren't qualified. And so they, in essence, did two things at once. They lowered class sizes and reduced teacher quality at the same time, and ultimately never knew what the impact of the policy was.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When looking at the research related to class size across other states, recognizing that Oregon has some of the largest class sizes in the nation, does that improvement at K-1 assume class sizes in the 20s for those larger grades, or does it take into account that in Oregon right now we have high school science classes that have between 45 and 60 students in them, or fifth grade classes with 36 students in them?
Well, again, with respect to what we do know in Tennessee, the move was from the mid-20s to 13 to 15 and maybe a little bit higher than that. So it was from what they considered at that point to be large to small. In Oregon, there are some districts, just based on their composition, that are already going to be, there'll be median sort of in around the 20s, but quite a few districts that are in those mid to high 20s. So you do have, at least in the K-1 level, a number of districts and classrooms that could be making the move that they made in Tennessee. With respect to all the other grade levels, there simply isn't the rigorous research base that was done in an experimental design, nor are there sort of the multiple studies of non-experiments, of quasi-experiments, that would give you the same level of comfort or same level of certainty around a relationship to achievement. And it's not necessarily because it doesn't exist, it's because it hasn't been measured in a scientific way.
Follow up. In your research with Oregon schools, what have you found the priorities of local school boards to be? I know that I've served on a school board for 5 years. I'm in a district that's made reductions every year for the last 16 years in excess of $1 million each year. And it's been our focus to protect those kindergarten, first, and second grade programs at the expense of our middle and high school programs. And what we see is that our achievement kind of drops off after the fifth grade because of those choices. Is this school district unusual, or do school districts across the state of Oregon, have local school boards been focused on research and investing in those primary grades?
If I think to the work that we've done on spending per student, I have not, and spending per student over time at different levels, and we've done some of that work for the Oregon Business Council since the early 90s, I have not seen a major difference in the rate of spending per student in K-5 versus the middle grades versus high school. That is, there's not a measurable difference in the acceleration of spending in K-5 versus middle and high school, but that's about as far as I can comment on that. There has been a sizable increase in pre-K spending over that period of time, but not at those other levels.
And there is an ongoing concern about the fall off in middle school, and there is a national organization that is actually focused on that specific area, so that's an interesting piece to integrate here too.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Representative Abakian.
With regard to that same issue of both lost programs, decreased funding, high class sizes in grades, say 3 through 6, I'm curious why you came to a conclusion to institute full-day kindergarten without solid data on what the drop-off of any increase in reading might be in those really early grades, K-1, with high class sizes and lost programs in grades 3 through 6.
I think the point, and it was a subtle one, the all-day kindergarten recommendation from Chalkboard is delayed a number of years, and the money are not allocated until, I believe, the 2012-13 school year, in the hopes that that proposal and that intervention will have proven itself between now and then. So there are a number of strategies, both those and the middle and high school interventions in the funding package, that have delayed implementation precisely because of research.
I want to make sure I understood what you just said. you're not recommending instituting full-day kindergarten now or in the next legislative session, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Okay. So what would the investments buy? Chalkboard asked us to answer those questions, and to the best of our ability, using the findings from the Tennessee study and from the tutoring, we were able to look at Oregon scores on the NAEP and then its own statewide assessments and draw the following conclusions. There's a paper, if you're more interested in looking at the paper and getting into the details. We estimate the full implementation of K-1 class size reductions could increase Oregon's average NAEP score by up to 4 points on math and reading. That, in some context, we are in and around the national average on most of those scores. They have not changed by much in terms of points over the course of time. So a 4-point change would be noticeable. And it's about 6 or 7 points that separates us from Minnesota, which is routinely a top performer on most of those tests. A 4-point boost in math and reading would make Oregon rank among the top third of states for both fourth and eighth grade math and reading tests. And for the eighth grade math test, Oregon could rank in the top 10. And then if we go to the next one, and we had to do this using statewide tests given the specificity of the data that we used, full implementation of the early reading tutor proposal could reduce the proportion of students failing to meet state reading benchmarks by up to 10% by eighth grade. And then, obviously, if you implement the class size reductions and the tutors at the same time, they could interact to sort of have a dynamic effect together. Nobody's measured that. Nobody's implemented them together and estimated the combined effect, but one would expect that there might be something more. And certainly, contingent on all of that is that you have good educators to implement this, and that I think, is the interaction with the quality education proposals.
The next piece of our work deals with the accountability provisions, and I think we've talked a lot about the problem, so I'm going to go straight to what we think some of the answers might be. And what we're talking about here are business practices of schools. And so the proposals that have come forth, again, from our finance working group really are these four. First, helping create a statewide efficiency program. And we see here a partnership between the Department of Education and OASBO, the Oregon School Business Managers Group, in identifying what are the areas in which we think efficiencies could be found. And we've come up with a preliminary list, but we think that they can help us go deeper. And then what are best practices that districts have used to improve their efficiency in those areas? And we see a system in which we would help districts know what those best practices are and how other districts had fared under them. And then we would couple that with performance reviews so that we would be going into districts every 5 years, perhaps looking at a different practice on that list. It could be procurement, it could be payroll processing, it could be different pieces, and seeing if those best practices have been adopted. The third proposal is about transportation spending, and that's one where our finance group actually spent a fair amount of time and came to the conclusion that the existing reimbursement formula does not incent districts to find efficiencies. So the proposal there is to revamp the formula. There's a phase-in while we're doing that where we would block grant what we're currently spending with a roll-up for inflation and fuel, and if districts can find savings in that amount, they would keep those dollars in their budgets while we're doing a revamp of the formula. And then the last piece is open books, which maybe thankfully doesn't need any legislative support but is going along quite well. It's interesting. It's just showing basic spending information right now. We're getting a lot of requests to enhance it, to show revenue, to show student achievement data. Right now we're linking to that, but it's not built into the site. Our test is, will Oregonians use it? And you're going to see some advertising around us from us in the fall around back to school, really encouraging people to spend 5 minutes on their school district site under the open books icon and taking a look at where their dollars are going. If we can demonstrate we can actually get people to use it, then we will enhance it. We think it's a powerful tool, and we're pleased so far with the support we've gotten.
There's one other piece that isn't specifically outlined here, but that our finance group recommended, and that is the elimination of permanent early retirement programs. That is happening across the state. And John, I'll let you speak directly to that one.
Right. There, early on in conversations with those knowledgeable of the system, early retirement programs that are permanent and foreseeable by staff don't have the same incentive effect as a periodic offer of early retirement in terms of being able to trade out higher compensated teachers and then replace them with lower compensated. And so the proposal there is to mandate that the districts bargain those out over a time horizon and accrue the savings from that.
We have costed out a savings target that results from all of the things you see here, and as we go into the funding proposals next, we'll show you how we've estimated that. I think the next slide is just a picture of Open Books. If you haven't seen it, we'd really encourage you to take a look at it and tell us how we can strengthen it. The next piece for us is funding. And again, I think we know the problem. So the issues here and the recommendations, again, really are the heart and soul of what Mr. Scherzinger's work group helped us put together. The first deals with the state school stability fund, and it calls for an expansion of that fund so that it would equal 10% of the general fund. We are also calling for both the corporate and personal kickers to fill that fund. The second, I think, is really the heart and soul of our proposals, which is to establish a new guaranteed level of state funding per student, a floor, if you will, and we're going to show you how we would calculate that. The next piece is new revenues. Under our current calculations and under both the governor's and the speaker's revenue plans for schools, our proposals could be paid for. So we're not talking about immediate new revenue source. But over time, if those economic forecasts don't hold, we may find ourselves in that position. And our finance group did not present us with a new tax reform option, but they did look at over 50 different ideas and really basically said, whatever we do, we can't go any deeper in our reliance on the income tax, which leads to the instability of the system we have. They would prefer a blended package. Plan A was the one, I think, that they blessed, and we have been taking a look at that. We think that is a discussion that comes after we've been able to make some of these changes, but will come inevitably in the future.
Excuse me, Representative Farr.
Thank you. Just back to the funding piece, Sue, just real quick. Now, you were talking about the instability of our income tax system. What about capital gains tax and how that plays in to the general fund? And, of course, since the general fund primarily, I mean, education takes the biggest piece of the pie from the general fund.
Can you answer that?
There is detail in the finance work group report, which goes on for, I think that one's more than 100 pages, in terms of a variety of different options. The general spirit and the recommendation that came out of that is that anything that is new that could potentially be added to existing tax sources would not be income tax based or related to income tax, because you'd be adding more volatility. I do not recall specifically a comment on the capital gains tax.
Well, just because if we are reliant on capital gains during a downturn in our economy, we aren't seeing that revenue. So that would definitely fit into, I think, the same piece as state income tax.
And certainly capital gains is recognized as one of the most volatile, along with corporate income taxes as well. A recommendation that the finance work group made was doubling the size of the Education Stability Fund to recognize that we have a highly volatile tax base. Certainly that would be your first incremental step if you made no changes to the tax system, would be to increase the size of the Education Stability Fund.
Thank you.
Okay, I think what we'd like to do now is show you how our spending guarantee would be crafted.
So the chart is an illustration of sort of the three major components of the spending guarantee as it was conceived by the finance work group. The navy blue line was a forecast developed by the work group in as much detail as you could imagine, with Jim Scherzinger and Brian Reeder and Nancy Heiligman and others, Paul Warner collaborating. And is the expectation, keep in mind, these are so-called current expenditures, the spending per student on ongoing operations and maintenance. So we're in this conversation, we're not talking about the capital side of the equation, but this is the ongoing operations and maintenance of the system. The thought process went this way. First of all, the first step would be, given what we have today, what will it cost at existing staffing levels to continue to fund that staff-to-student ratio going forward? And there, the notion was one would turn to cost and inflation expectations that that are used by both the private and the public sector in terms of what would you expect salaries and wages to grow by, what would you expect health benefits to grow by. We did a lot of modeling around PERS and the phase-in of the OPCERT program that was built into the expectation, and then the roughly 15% that is non-wages and salaries were assumed to grow with the CPI. With a salary assumption of 3.3% and health insurance growth expected over this period of 6.2%, which is a private sector expectation as well, we end up with the navy blue baseline growing, and so you have current expenditures, and these are this is obviously taking inflation into account, allowing it to grow with inflation, from spending per fall enrollee growing from about $9,000 to almost $11,000, a little bit more than that, in 2014-15. So that's your unadjusted current services baseline, for lack of a better definition. Then the work group said, but we do know that there are some things that we could be doing better. And that's where the efficiencies come in. So we assumed that the state would implement a reform around transportation funding. And implicit in that, we assumed that Oregon spending per student transported would eventually move toward a level that's more consistent with Washington's, which is lower than Oregon's. Now, that was one assumption. The second one would be the implementation of the performance audits that we talked about earlier, to move those other support service expenditures and bring them in line with the national average, that best practices would be developed by a central core of business experts and audited and disseminated to districts, and eventually savings would be accrued. And then finally, the gradual elimination of the permanent, or bargaining out of the permanent early retirement programs. Those are the three pieces that we assumed, and by taking those out, you then get that that pink line, which is called the efficient baseline. To that, then, is added the chalkboard initiatives. And so the pink, in essence, is the efficient baseline, would be estimated on a periodic basis, on an annual basis, by an office like the state economist, and reported to the governor, put into the governor's budget, and advanced to the legislature for approval. Then to implement the incentives, we're looking at a structure similar to what is operating in Pennsylvania. There they have something called accountability grants, where they have added to their current law expenditures through block grants. They are districts have to they have to account for their spending under the block grant, but they are not competitive. All districts are eligible and receive them. And there is a menu of interventions that one can fund with those block grant dollars. And in Pennsylvania's structure, it's a longer list than chalkboard would propose, but it includes many of the same features. They do have class size reductions in the early grades. They have early reading tutors in K-3. They do go into a full and half day, which chalkboard would not recommend in the short term, and then some other interventions as well. But that block grant would then be added to that pink efficient baseline to generate the green spending path, which would be the spending under the chalkboard proposal. If you turn to the next, if we look at the next slide, you can see this proposal spelled out in dollars per fall enrollee, and those are the amounts per fall enrollee that would be spent under each category. The efficient baseline there, you can see those amounts in terms of spending per fall enrollee. Again, these amounts, and I didn't emphasize this to begin with, are considering all revenue sources. So we are projecting state revenue, local revenue, and federal revenue that would be available. As we did this forecast, we made very explicit assumptions about where we thought property taxes were going. Those are relatively easy to predict under the Measure 5 and 50 growth limits, but also where federal dollars were going, which I think this state needs to pay close attention to going forward, because discretionary federal dollars that are not defense-related and are not Medicaid or Medicare are going to become increasingly scarce, in our view, over the course of the next decade, and the state, and in terms of its funding of K-12, needs to pay attention to that. So these dollars are forecasts of all spending from all revenue sources. So the efficient baseline produces that level. Then you can see the investment in the early age initiatives as forecasted by the Finance Work Group starting in the 08-09 school year with partial implementation and then gradually phasing in into full scale by the 2011-2012 at $278 per fall enrollee. That gradual implementation is very intentional so that Oregon doesn't repeat the mistakes of California, where you have an abrupt and not well implemented intervention and have too many teachers to hire all at once. California and their expansion had to triple the number of teachers in 1 year that they hired under their system, and by all accounts, it was a disaster.
Not to mention they didn't have the facilities. So
and they had severe facility problems, and probably civility as well, given the crowd. teacher quality performance audits and transparency, those dollars are not nearly as large as class size reductions and tutoring, but nonetheless are critical in our view to making sure that you've got the good teachers to both do the tutoring and the class size reductions. And then you can see the delayed implementation beginning in 2012-13 of all-day kindergarten, middle, and high school. Again, the idea there from the finance group's perspective was that over this period of time, we will have demonstrated the impact of the class size reductions. The all-day kindergarten, hopefully that research will have matured, and so we can understand better how to strategically implement it, and that hopefully over that period of time, research will have matured in the middle and high school areas so that there could be dollars targeted to specific dropout prevention activities or other interventions that are better defined than they are today.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the thoughtfulness with which you've done this. I think that phasing this in the way that you've done allows, as you've said, for the performance measures to be clearly stated and for the people to see that the investments are, in fact, achieving the gains that were intended for them to be made. But also, it, I think, gives the people that are the policymakers and the fiscal folks in education time to deal with the staffing needs and the building needs that need to be in place to deal with all-day kindergarten and smaller class sizes all throughout the system. I think that the investments in training people to step into those positions that are qualified to do them, and then to make sure that the infrastructure is there, the buildings and the equipment and that kind of thing, are things that we need to be very thoughtful about. Those are not insignificant undertakings for the state. So again, I think this is a great piece of work, and I think that it presents a very reasonable methodology towards implementation.
The other nice feature of Pennsylvania system is that if you put the money into a block grant and provide options, then if one size doesn't fit all, for example, there may be districts that already have low class sizes in K-1, they could then use those resources for the tutoring initiative, and so they can be flexible in terms of the features that they implement. In addition, at the bottom of, the previous one very quickly, there are also resources assumed in here for implementation of a state-funded alternative compensation system. The dollars that are in that are sufficient, would be sufficient to give a 5% per student increase to districts with 20% of the students. And again, it would be a voluntary opt-in system. The district and its union would agree that they wanted to participate in the system. They'd come forward with an application and then would get a per student boost for that.
May I ask one more question?
Representative Morgan.
The 0607 and the level that is the efficient baseline is significantly above where we will probably begin the discussion for the next biennium. Is what's the discussion inside Chalkboard given the likelihood of coming up with those kinds of numbers? Or is this just an academic presentation?
No. Well, that is a spending on page 37. That is a expenditure per fall enrollee figure that shouldn't be confused with the state. And it's all funds. It includes federal, et cetera.
Funds.
So it's, right.
Thank you.
So it is an academic, but it is our expectation of what Oregon actually will be spending in that year.
And if I may, Representative Morgan, in your packet, there's this piece which goes a lot deeper into the numbers if you wanted to look at that.
And the next page is state funding.
Yes. This piece basically says, okay, well, now let's take those per fall enrollee numbers and turn them into millions of dollars at the top in the same categories of the efficient baseline, et cetera. Again, this is all... this is the total, and it will require all revenue sources to contribute to it. And then, since this is a spending guarantee, not a revenue guarantee, what the finance work group did is say, okay, let's, under existing economic projections, let's go look at four revenue alternatives that have been that could play themselves out or have been proposed, and see how this spending plan fares under those alternatives. So the four alternatives were a constant share of general fund assumption, where the K-12 would receive the same share of the general fund as it did in the existing biennium that we're in. A declining share of general fund assumption, where one would assume that extraordinary Medicaid and corrections costs would gradually erode a K-12 share of the general fund over time. And then the speaker's plan and the governor's plan, the speaker's plan being the 51% income tax dedication, and the governor's plan being 61% of the general fund to education generally. As we looked at, modeled those, and then made the same assumption of other revenue, under each of those plans, we assumed the same amount of local and federal money would be available. We forecast that under the constant share assumption, under the state economist's current projection, there's actually running a surplus in terms of the money that would be available relative to that spending proposal. The declining share runs a slight deficit and then small surpluses, and then eventually hits the same level in 2013-14. As we modeled the speaker's plan, relative to these expenditures, we found that generally over that period, if you implemented the speaker's revenue plan, it would essentially balance in most years with the chalkboard's spending proposal. And then the governor's plan would create some surpluses above the chalkboard spending proposal. I think the key difference between the speaker's plan one of the key differences in terms of money that's available for ongoing operations and maintenance of the speaker's plan generates a larger capital fund over time as well, which is not recognized on these charts because we're only talking about operations and maintenance. So the bottom line here is that if Tom Petowski is right, and this economy continues on the path that he is projecting it, that under these four revenue futures, that the chalkboard proposal is either adequately funded or there's actually some excess revenue, surplus revenue that would be available to, or there's some cushion, I guess I would say. Certainly, somewhere over this period, one would expect the possibility of recession. I think the point that chalkboard would take there is that redoubles the need for the expansion of the Education Stability Fund to weather those storms when they come to pass.
Mm-hmm. So those are our major buckets of proposals at this point in time. And as Adam mentioned, we've been out surveying Oregonians and talking about them to get feedback. Pretty much we've got positive feedback about all of them. There are some differences across the state about the priority in which you'd pursue them, and there's been a fair amount of suggestions of ways to enhance them. But I think we're feeling at this point like this this platform has support from Oregonians across the state. Now, this isn't everything that's in our action plan. There are other items we'd like to just bring you up to speed on what we're doing. I think we've talked a lot about what we're doing in the parent and community involvement arena. We don't see a legislative proposal here. We are funding lots of different promising practices in school districts. You can see them there. We're also working with the Department of Ed about how will we measure parental involvement. Could we get to the point where we would have a measurement on the Oregon report card, and what would be meaningful? How do we know that school districts are really evolving in this area? That's part of why we're funding the discussions at the district level, but we also want to see some sort of state emphasis on this piece. So that's where we are with that. We also talked a bit about attendance. We're concerned that Oregon's education officials are identifying absenteeism as a more significant issue than their peers in other states. We don't quite know the answer, but as John indicated earlier, we know we should be tracking this in a common way across the state so we can look at our performance. Again, we're working with the Department of Ed about options to do that. So I think that work will continue on before we would come to the legislature with any piece of that. The next one is, how do we create civility in schools, respectful and safe learning environments? There's lots of good work going on across Oregon with this. Springfield and Lake Oswego are particularly grappling with it, and we're watching their process. We're really looking for some model programs that we can help share as best practices across the state. We're talking with the Oregon School Boards Association about a partnership around this issue. We found that this really resonated with Oregonians of all stripes. They want schools to be civil places where children are learning life skills that will help them as adults. And there are lots of different perspectives about how that can happen. We want to make sure the conversation's happening. So again, we're looking for models there. We also looked at the issue of choice within the public school system. We found a lot of support in our early polling from Oregonians around the concept of statewide open enrollment. And that's still on our list. We would like to do some demonstration projects first with that between districts. And we have put together a proposal, an RFP, around that and are at the moment pursuing that direction. The next is student health. This is an area which came up often in our focus groups as such an important part, that children are healthy and well-fed and have slept well and can come to school ready to learn. We know there are lots of models around that. We are frankly not going deeply here, but supporting other efforts that are going on around chalkboard to really look at those issues. Also around choice within public schools are some of the charter school issues. The things that have come up in our work are questions around who can sponsor charter schools. Should we be looking at expanding that list to universities or community colleges or ESDs or neighboring school districts? Also the question of use of facilities when there are unutilized school buildings. Can charter schools be in those spaces and can negotiate in good faith for equal access to those facilities? Also a piece around funding. Are the funding levels appropriately set where they are? Those are all questions we're still looking at. We're still getting information on. We know that there is public interest in all of those.
I'm sorry, funding levels of what?
charter schools. So that brings us really to the challenge, you know it so well, and we've learned it, that we really have a communications challenge with Oregonians in helping them understand what the future can look like if we can make some of the investments we just laid out to you, and helping to create a vision that's compelling, that really inspires and motivates people to think about the future. I think one of the really fulfilling things about Chalkboard has been the hopefulness that we've heard as we've gone around the state. Certainly we encountered a lot of fatigue from people about this issue. I'm sure you're fatigued. I know we're a little fatigued now too. But we also heard, you know, Oregon can do better. And we have a hope for that, and we hope that Chalkboard and other groups that are out there, the legislature, can find this moment in time to really help Oregon plot that next path. And so we're encouraged by that. Again, I want to sum up by just reminding you really what Oregonians have said to us. They want schools to be better, but they don't want to destroy the current system. We didn't find majority support for vouchers. What we heard was, let's make the current system better. Teachers are revered. We've talked about that a lot. We also want teachers to be accountable. We want poor performers to be dealt with. We want superstars to be supported. We want all teachers to have the kind of classroom supports they need to do the best job that they can. I would add administrators in there as well. People feel strongly about their local schools. Generally, their favorability ratings about their local schools are much higher than when you ask them how they think about schools statewide. Maybe not a surprise, but that's a reality. But they want Oregon schools to be among the best in the nation. Chalkboard's interpreted that as meaning a top 10 performing school system, and what would it take for Oregon to be in the top 10? And you've seen what we think about that so far. We think those early age investments have the most potential to move us into that realm. But all of our reforms together, the teacher supports, the early age investments, the business practices accountability, stable funding, all of that to us adds up to a path that moves Oregon in that direction. In terms of what happens next, again, we are finalizing our process and really moving towards a mid-fall announcement of our final package. And we are building a statewide citizen advocacy group with representatives from every county who have participated in this process and who are eager to see it move forward. We are spending a lot of time with stakeholders right now, really listening to them. We've listened to them throughout the process, but now that our proposals are more concrete, we're getting a lot more input. And so that's an important piece for us to really understand from their perspective where there's common ground. And we are hearing some common ground. So in the end, 80% of Oregonians have told us they want schools among the nation's best. We think we are plotting the path to do that. And we, again, so much appreciate the opportunity to share the work here. There are lots of questions that you raised that we'll come back with answers to. And with that, Chairman Flores, I think we're done.
Thank you. We have about less than 10 minutes if there are questions for Sue or John and Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I would like, I have several questions. We don't have time. Can I submit my questions to Mr. Keller to give to Sue and get some written comments so we don't, is that a possibility? And so everyone, then he can be sure all the committee members are aware of those questions or something.
Absolutely.
Is that a way to handle this?
But you could do that unless you'd like to pop some of them out there. Okay. Then submit them through Jim. Jim will be the communication link here. Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of the topics that you covered today are similar to what the Quality Education Commission has also looked at. Could you talk a little bit about how we should respond to your information relative to what the commission has given us?
Mm-hmm. We probably both have different responses to that. Representative Avakian, we have used the QEM heavily in our work in terms of evaluating the best practices that were in the model. And we would say that what we've just outlined to you is really an implementation plan for the best parts of the QEM. And we think the ones that are the most validated are those early age investments and teacher quality pieces. And as I mentioned, we've taken QEM numbers around middle and high school and plugged them into our model, even though we're not convinced the practices identified there around lower class size are the right ones at this time. We think the research is maturing there. But I would say we looked at the work that was done there pretty extensively. and John's group, in particular the finance group, used it. We invited the QEM leadership to come in and talk with us. They've now approached us about trying to incorporate the efficiency work that we've done into their model. So actually, I think the two efforts are strengthening each other.
I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I think the folks have talked about the quality education model now for many years, and the question within that is, if you were going to adopt it, where might you start? And this, I believe, through Chalkboard, is one of the very first attempts to say, okay, within that framework, there are probably 30 different levers you could turn within the quality education model. And it's the levers on K-1 class size reduction and tutoring and quality educators, which I believe are all in parts of the quality education model, would be the first ones that, in my view, the legislature would want to turn on if they expect those investments to drive achievement.
Specifically referencing the areas that where the investments would be made rather than not directing them to be made in specific areas, which is the distinction, as I understand it, with Quality Education Commission's model.
One of the things that the commission has presented to us on more than one occasion is emphasizing restoring lost programs. And as the three top examples, music, arts, and physical education, mostly as a way to retain the boost you give kids in the early models that you've provided. And then second, elimination of participation fees, which exclude some low-income kids from very important programs, and not just football and band, but as an example, I pay a participation fee for my kids in their science class, so a core subject. But I haven't seen any information from you on incorporating those items, restoration of lost programs, elimination of participation fees, as a part of your budget model. If you could comment on that for a minute.
Generally, that issue relates to where do you start? Where is the jumping off point to start the blue line that you saw on that one chart? And is it this school year? Or is it the school year, next year's school year, or the school year after that? Because one might imagine, under the current economic projections and current law, that there could be some restoration of some of those programs in the upcoming school years, depending on ballot measures and other changes to law. But it is. That was certainly considered, and I think it is something that will be debated within Chalkboard and outside Chalkboard once Chalkboard develops its recommendation. Is where do you start that blue line and move forward, and which school year are you jumping off from? With respect to arts and music, physical education, and the like, I would also point you back to the 200-page report on improving education quality, and there is discussion of those investments and the evidence that exists in terms of relationships to achievement that's known to this point.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the discussion about the relationship between the quality education model and the work that the Chalkboard Project did. We have had, I think, excellent discussions in this process around the quality education model and the use of the model as a tool to further a discussion about the level of investment in the system. I think the thing that is refreshing to me about the work that the Chalkboard Project's done is that it is actually clearly working in the evidence-based realm, and that you're looking at the research that's been done and striving to find the things that make the biggest difference in student achievement. And I think that that's actually one of the weaknesses of the quality education model, in that it is more of a research-based model and is not real grounded in things that have actually been found in practice to raise student achievement. But I think that, again, it's the combination of both of the perspectives on this that is going to help us understand what works and what doesn't work and what makes the most sense to invest money in. And I think that from the information that you've given the committee today, what I am personally taking away from this is an appreciation of the how you have based your discussion in research or actual outcomes, things that have been seen over time to improve performance, and given us a real pragmatic on the street approach to implementing that. So I very much thank you for the work that you've done and for the information that you've left us with.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. Well, I just had a question. You talked about some of the work that you did with the Department of Ed. And a school district within my legislative district, the Bethel School District, has seen great success in student performance with a reading initiative that they've implemented. Mm-hmm. And we're in the process of looking at implementing a math program, because while we've seen a huge jump in student performance in reading, we haven't seen that same increase in math performance, and I think that's statewide. So I was just curious to know if you had spoken with the Department of Ed about using that model that's been such a great success in a very challenged school district, and maybe use that in other districts in the state that are seeing the same challenges.
Mm-hmm. Representative Farr, we've learned a lot from Bethel. We've gone to Bethel on several issues, and I think you're referring to Reading First.
Yes.
Which has been so successful there. That's part of what we talk about when we talk about reading tutors. That's a model that we think has been very successful, so we have been promoting that.
Great. Representative Roblin, we're winding down.
Okay. More of a comment. I just wanted to thank the Chalkboard Project for having been a part of this for a long time and having had the opportunity to grow with you. And I know it's a lot of learning for some of the people who haven't been doing that, and I have appreciated that a lot. And I really do appreciate the fact that in everything I have seen, this has been a project that they went out to look for answers and not with any bias going in about how to go get those answers. And I, for one, believe strongly that that has been the case. And the other thing that I have been struck by through all the research and all the information, and I think we don't spend enough time acknowledging it, is that we have had less investment in our schools over the years because of very difficult economic times for a long time. And the districts, the local districts, the local school boards, the teachers, and the administrators have worked very hard while they have had less to continue to improve in the performance of their kids. And they have succeeded in improvement. Now, we don't agree. Everybody would like it to be a greater improvement. But I think what Chalkboard is showing is that there has to be an investment if you want that improvement to get better than it is currently. But I want to make sure that everybody really understands the teachers and the people who work in these districts have done amazing work over the last 15 and 16 years through economic difficult times and a lot of stress on the system to continue to improve the caliber of students that are coming out. And to every year, there have been little improvements, even though they haven't had a whole lot to work with to get those improvements. Mm-hmm. And local districts have made really difficult decisions on how to invest their money and do things. And I have watched, you know, these meetings over and over again with peers. I mean, these people do not want to have to make the decisions they're making, but they've looked for evidence. And I think, and I'm pleased that Chalkboard is telling us right today that it's difficult to find good evidence out there, because though school districts have been knowing that for a long time. I mean, they have been trying to figure out how do I invest the little money I have in the right ways to make the best improvement. And I am shocked at how well they've done, personally, with very little guidance. And over and over again, these school boards and these other people and the teachers that implement those and the administrators that are helping get there continue to improve. And it was shocking to me when I was in it. It's shocking to me even now as I watch what's going on. And I thank Chalkboard for taking the time, investing the money, in talking to people, and hopefully having a real discussion out there with everybody to clarify and to get correct information out, because I think there is a lot of misinformation. And there are, as you point out, 80% of the people are not connected to the schools today. Mm-hmm. That is a big effort we're going to have to make to inform people about things. And I am really pleased to hear that you're starting an initiative in September to get that information out about open books and about other things. So real information is out there. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm just holding people in their saddles. Thank you very much to Ann, Dawn, and everyone, Foundation members who I think have kind of moved on with their days. But thank you very much for coming down. We certainly appreciate the information, and we look forward to working with you further. Members, once again, thank you very much. Your comments were very right on, Representative Roblin, as well as what Susan Morgan had expressed. As we move forward in this effort to review and analyze some extensive inputs of time, resource, and expertise, that we be very open-minded and nonpartisan, Representative Bakken, in our philosophical approach to this. I'm just joking with you. Okay. And I'm just certainly toying with you.
I think it has nothing to do with partisanship, just a positive perspective on where we should be going with public education.
I think that we are all concerned about looking at how we best increase student achievement for our children. And our next meeting in this regard with this committee will be on September 13th. I think you've all seen a list of the proposed dates. And just duly note, Mr. Keller will be getting information that's been requested from various members and other information that you will be providing. So with that, unless there are any further comments, questions, okay, none, see none, we'll adjourn. Thank you.